Are we ready, guys?
We are already recording.
House Committee on Education will come to order. It is Wednesday, May 28th. Welcome back, everybody, to our May Legislative Days. We have a lot of folks in the room today. We also have some special visitors, and I saw Representative Springer had a chance to talk with some folks personally. But these are students from Vernon School in Northeast Portland. We have 6th through 8th graders, and Principal Tina Tucker is here. So welcome to your state capital. Feel free to email or call any of us anytime, and if you want to come back for another visit, we have page programs and internship programs, and I know that all of us at the panel are always glad to see you here and want you to come back as often as you can and maybe think about running for office sometime. And for everyone else in the room, we are going to go in the order of the agenda today. We have a number of issues on the agenda that people care a lot about. I know a number of you have asked if you can be added to the agenda. There are several of you. Unfortunately, we don't have time in the agenda to add additional speakers, but we will hold the record open through the end of... Can we hold it open until Friday?
Sure. Yeah.
Till Friday, and then if you email that testimony or your comments in, it will be distributed to everybody on the committee, and it also will go up onto OLIS, which means that any member of the public can then access that and see it. And when you email that in, we'll also, can we make sure that they get back the information about how to access OLIS?
Absolutely.
So that they can see it there? And you can see all of the materials there, including the PowerPoints for all of the presentations that we have today. And if you have other questions about that, feel free to contact me after the meeting. I'm sure this is not the last opportunity we'll have to talk about some of these issues. Also, just a reminder that it is a beautiful spring day, but it's a legislative hearing. So even though the topics that we're talking about are exciting, and I know many of us are passionate about them, I know I am, a couple of these in particular, no signs, no clapping, no booing, cheering, or chanting, but yes, thinking and writing down questions and having good conversations with each other. So any questions from the committee? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would the chair be willing to have the last one go before career and technical education? Representative Huffman and I heard the presentation, higher ed, this morning, and had a very good discussion. If that was
okay. Are Laura and John here yet in the room? As long as that is okay with the presenters, could we have somebody find out if we can do that? We'll try to accommodate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other? So if the speakers can accommodate that, we will shift that so you can not duplicate. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in that vein, I just want to let you know, unfortunately, I have a 4 o'clock appointment, so I don't want anybody to think I'm leaving because I don't want to hear a particular piece of testimony. I just do have to leave at 4 o'clock
okay.
for another meeting.
Very good. Very good. And Representative Gomberg, did you say you had to leave early as well?
No, I was supposed to be late, but I'm here.
Well, thank you for coming. It's good to have you all back. Okay. Anything else for the good of the order before we start? No? Great. All right. So we're going to start with the item on financial aid for students with modified and extended diplomas. And I would invite Sarah Drinkwater, Ben Cannon, and John Wyckoff, who have all been working very hard on this issue. And I think Sarah will kick it off, but I first wanted to offer a note of thanks to each of you. I know I've been pretty persistent in communicating with you about this issue, and all of you have been extremely responsive, and it really means a lot to the students who are going to be able to access financial aid. So thank you for being gracious and patient and so focused on the outcomes for the kids. Sarah.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelzer and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Drinkwater, Assistant Superintendent at Oregon Department of Education Student Services Unit. I do have a short PowerPoint that will guide us through some information. I thought it was the easiest way to do so. So I will go ahead and move through it. You're probably familiar that we have diploma options in Oregon that require students to demonstrate knowledge and skills, and that we have a high expectation for all students. As a part of ORS 329.451, there are three high school diplomas listed, the Oregon Diploma, the Modified Diploma, and the Extended Diploma. Giving you a little bit of a historical perspective related to federal financial aid, back in 1965, the Higher Education Act provided for the opportunity for students to apply and receive for federal financial assistance for college. Within that act was a clause called the Ability to Benefit Clause, and that benefit clause was removed in 2011 and became enacted in July 2012. And what it did was eliminate federal student aid eligibility for students without a certificate of graduation or a high school diploma. The Ability to Benefit clause included an assessment where it was determined that the student had an ability to benefit from post-secondary education, but that was no longer available starting July 2012. Oregon's Modified Diploma was approved by the State Board in 2009. And it includes specific eligibility and credit essential skill requirements. Back in 2009, there was some guidance requested. ODE requested some information and guidance from the Special Education Department of the U.S. Department of Education as to whether this new modified diploma met the requirements for as a high school diploma for federal financial aid. At that time, there was some information shared. I wasn't here at that time, but I have tried to gather some information, and it was shared with people in the special ed department that the modified diploma did not meet the requirements. And so at that time, ODE did move forward and share with colleagues and other agencies that the modified diploma did not meet requirements. But at that time, again, students were able to establish the ability to benefit, and they may have received federal financial aid from 2009 up till July 2012 under the Ability to Benefit clause if they had a modified diploma. So recently, many of us, or I should say some of us, have had some conversations with different staff at the U.S. Department of Education, reviewed information and Dear Colleague guidance letters, and Representative Gelser herself also met with staff from the U.S. Department of Education regarding this question and the modified diploma. Within the guidance, there are some definitions that are provided that the student must have a certificate of graduation from a school providing secondary education. There has been some concern over the years about diploma mills and how did a student receive a diploma? Did they pay for something online? The high school diploma is the basic qualification awarded to a student who graduates, and a high school diploma may be used to meet the general eligibility requirements. So the Oregon Diploma is one, if a student receives that, they're eligible for federal and state financial assistance for college and they're able to apply to the military. The Modified Diploma, the students are eligible for federal and state financial aid for college and they may also apply to the military. The Extended Diploma, there are students who may be appropriate to apply and go through a transition program at community colleges, and with their extended diploma they may be eligible to apply for federal financial aid for that type of program. In some cases it may be that the military, with reviewing, it would be up to the military to determine, but they could discuss with the military if they might be eligible. I summarized information from a guidance paper or notification from the U.S. Department of Education that came out in January 2014. Is a certificate of high school completion sufficient for a student to be eligible for Title IV funding? And the answer was no. Generally, a certificate of high school completion is not, meaning not a high school diploma. And the U.S. Department of Education relies on a state's determination as to what constitutes a high school diploma, including whether a certificate of high school completion is equivalent or not, and that institutions should check with the state about that. And so in this instance, a modified diploma and an Oregon diploma or a standard diploma, and then in the cases of the extended diploma for those who are applying for transitional type programs at a post-secondary would be eligible for federal, to apply for federal financial aid. It doesn't answer the question whether they are to receive it. They would be eligible to apply. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Sarah before we move on? And so just to be clear, the Oregon Modified Diploma is the same for regardless of which district it is. So a college wouldn't have to wonder, does it apply to this Modified Diploma or that Modified Diploma?
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, that is correct, because the Modified Diploma and the requirements are set forth in the ORS and the OAR. So they are the same. It isn't... A district may have some sort of other attendance certificate that they give students that they determine, but related to the Oregon Standard Diploma, the modified and the extended, those requirements are already in the delineated in the ORSs.
And then can you talk a little bit about the efforts of the department to communicate this information to students and administrators in school districts in terms of what to expect when they graduate with a modified or an extended diploma?
Yes. Representative Gelser and members of the committee, we have issued, Oregon Department of Education issued a numbered memo that went out to an extensive listserv that included educators and other interested people who could be on listservs. It went to special education, it went to superintendents, etc. We have also communicated that in newsletters and provided to districts a template for a communication that they could send out to parents. We have also clarified some questions with the U.S. Department of Education and have had several phone conversations with them as well.
Thank you very much. Ben.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director, Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and here just very briefly to say that following the determination by Oregon's Department of Education that the modified diploma was eligible for federal financial aid, I conveyed that to the colleges and universities, public and private, in Oregon, noting the determination by the Oregon Department of Education and fielding their questions, frankly, about that decision. I also noted to them, and I would note to this committee, that a student's eligibility for federal financial aid does not mean necessarily that it's appropriate for a student to obtain federal financial aid, and that, and particularly when loans are part of the package, as they often are. And that is really a determination that should be made on a case-by-case basis by the student, typically, perhaps with their family, and hopefully with some guidance and counseling from a college. And that's true for all students, not just modified diploma or extended diploma students, but regular diploma students as well, where we hope there is a real clear and concerted effort to determine whether it is appropriate for a student to incur the debt typically associated with federal financial aid and to look at their level of readiness, again, apart from just whether or not they have what diploma they have, their level of readiness, their likelihood to succeed, their career goals and opportunities. So that, I think, is an important sort of cautionary note alongside this quite, I think, hopeful and positive news that the state has determined they are eligible for federal financial aid.
Thank you very much.
Great. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record. My name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association, representing Oregon's 17 community colleges. And wanted to just speak to the community colleges' take on this, and I think what had been some early confusion on this. I think one of the things that had changed that was unfortunate at the federal level was the wholesale removal of the ability to benefit rule, which I think that the feds were trying to get at some narrower issues that they use a pretty broad approach for, because the ability to benefit really did provide an avenue for students that didn't have necessarily a traditional diploma but were definitely college ready, and so we don't have it anymore. And at the federal level, I do think there is another look at that, and maybe we need an alternate test at the federal level for this. But so our folks had been operating on the other understanding that these sorts of diplomas weren't, because that had been practiced up until then. So I think when there was some pushback from our financial aid directors when they first got this information, because it was not the understanding that they had had. And for them, what our financial aid folks, when they think about these issues, what they think about is if they're giving financial aid to or a student who turns out not to be eligible by a federal by a federal definition, well, the college would be on the hook for paying back the grants, and that's unfortunate, but it's not a huge deal. But it's but the student would have to pay back the loans, and at that point might be told that you're not actually eligible for further aid, so you can't complete your degree or certificate, and now you owe loans. Well, that's a crisis for that person. Mm-hmm. That's more than unfortunate. So that was kind of the concern. That was where there was, I think, a reticence from some of our financial aid directors about moving forward, because it was different than the understanding they had, and they would never want to put a student in the situation where they're kind of stuck holding the bag. But since then, we've gotten very clear direction from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission through Ben that it is the determination of the state that these diplomas meet that federal definition, and so that's the colleges are operating on that direction and just moving forward in that way, and unless we hear otherwise from the HEC or from the feds, and I think we also continue to hope that there will be at the federal level a look at having some kind of ability to benefit rule again, so that we're not, I think, probably in all 50 states having to find very creative ways to find these avenues for students who are college ready and should have the ability to access and pay for college. And so we want to continue to be productive in this conversation and to help these students move forward in every way possible. I think that one area that for the colleges maybe could use some more clarification might be around the extended diplomas. And just that when I was listening to your presentation, it was actually different than, and this isn't your fault, than the understanding that I walked in with, and which I just think means that we have some more communication that needs to go. I think it's a bit more nuanced with extended diplomas than I had realized. And so I just think there's more communication that has to continue to happen so that all of our directors have the right, so we're all on the same page and have the right information.
Thank you. And all 17 are now handling those applications the same way they would for a standard diploma.
The presidents all got together and talked about this after we'd gotten, there's a lot of email going around. And all talked about it and said, okay, we're all doing this. We're all going to talk to our financial aid people. We're taking a statewide approach to this because we've been given direction from the HEC and from that this is the policy.
Thank you. Representative Springer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a couple questions with your indulgence, please.
Yes.
So, Sarah, I heard you mention that there's been several phone conversations with federal government regarding this. I think I heard that maybe in a piece of that in somebody else's testimony. And if it has been sent to me, I missed it, and I apologize. But do we have anything in writing from the federal government saying, yes, this is okay? Because I know when I call, even I call an agency, a state agency or federal agency, I can get more than one answer, and I can't go back on, but you said. So do we have anything in writing?
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, in our conversations, and it's the conversations that I have had or others in my office with U.S. Department of Education, they have indicated they will not be putting anything in writing. If you go back to the guidance of 2014, January, it does state that it's up to a state to make that determination. So there has been nothing forthcoming in writing.
And I can follow up on that. When I went to Washington, D.C. to meet with the federal officials, I actually met with the Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Education and asked for something to follow up to bring back. And what they sent and pointed to was that guidance that was issued just in this January. The clarification that happened in that meeting, and what's been difficult is we haven't been able to find, unless since we've last talked, that kind of this 2009 letter that we've talked about. Nobody has really seen what that has said. So we're not sure what the question was. It's two different questions. Is it an equivalent to a high school diploma, or is it a high school diploma? And when meeting with the U.S. Department of Ed, what they pointed out is that each state has within its authority to determine what is a high school diploma. And they looked at ours and said, look, you have this in your statute. You have it in your 40-40-20 statute. It's listed as a completion document separate from the alternative certificate. So this is up to the states. And they talked about other states have less rigorous outcomes for students who might be on an IEP that can do a lot of modifications within the regular diploma, and they're handed a regular diploma and they have access to financial aid. And that's why they point it back to the state, and what they sent back in writing, and I can forward you that email from them, is look at this part right here.
So follow up on that?
Follow up.
So and I understand what the policy goal here is, and we've talked about this at length, and I'm all on board with the policy goal. I just want to make sure that when we arrive there, that there's been no collateral damage, and so I just want to go through a couple of these pieces. So because the Title IV funding is from the federal government, there's always strings attached, do we have... what is the likelihood or the possibility of at some point the federal government saying, no, that isn't right, and then we have students, I hate to see the colleges on the hook for dollars because those are taxpayer dollars, but the college can deal with that. But a student who applies for financial aid and receives grants because there's a financial need. And I just want to do everything we can to assure that we're not going to be handing a surprise in the second semester or quarter to a student that, whoops, this is a problem. So what have we done to shore up those? I don't know. Maybe that's a good question for you, Ben.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Springer. I think it's an important concern and an important point of attention. I agree with you as well as with John that the last thing we want is for a student to be on the hook for financial aid that it turns out was, you know, inappropriately administered. At this point, we have relied on the U.S. Department of Education's continued pointing to the guidance that Representative Gelser pointed out and Sarah included in her testimony that establishes that states determine what constitutes a diploma. And I share your desire for and hope for even clearer statement from the U.S. Department of Ed that our determination is, you know, that they like it or they have, you know, some faith in it. I think that would be very helpful in satisfying the anxiety that you and I know some of the colleges feel. That said, they continue, when we ask the question, and I've been on the phone with them too, they continue to point to this page that says, states decide, states decide, states decide. So that's the answer I continue to get. I realize that doesn't answer your question of what's the risk here, but it is the answer that we've received.
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, I will also add that we have organized, maybe it will be the final call with U.S. Department of Education on Monday that will include several other colleagues from their post-secondary division and a couple of us from the Department of Education to, I think, make sure we're all on the same page. And so hopefully after Monday there may be sort of the final information that all is well and I can let the two of you know the outcome of that phone call.
And my understanding from some of the conversations that some of the reluctance around a written statement that talks about modified diplomas is that Oregon is unique in that we have a statute that describes statewide standards. So what is granted in Sweet Home as a modified diploma is the same thing as in Portland. In most states, it's something that's much more informal, and district by district can decide, it's graduation week, we're giving you this modified diploma. So it's not a change about modified diplomas and the position of the U.S. post-secondary division on modified diplomas. It's that question of, does a state determine what is a successful high school completion document and what are those things? And in this case for Oregon, it's in our statute, our administrative rule, in our 44-20.
Thank you. Can I have one more?
Yeah.
And I think I'll be done. So I guess, John, this question's to you since you're here on behalf of community colleges and didn't see a president. Where did the direction come from to implement this for the colleges to move forward?
From Ben.
Came from that. I mean,
Chair Gelser, members of the committee. I mean, we received a notification from the Oregon Department of Education that the rules had changed, and I think at that point some of our colleges looked and said, "This doesn't sound right." And then I think at that point Ben's office got involved, and made a determination that that was that is the policy. And so at that point, we said, well, okay, we've heard from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission now, and that is the policy.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gomberg.
Nope.
Representative Parrish.
So following to Representative Springer's questions a little bit, first of all, I appreciate the community colleges. We put a lot on you. We don't give you the additional dollars to do that, and then you continue to do the work. So I want to state that. Should the federal government come in and audit the financial aid department of any community college, which if they come in and do one and then they come around and say, you know, this is a problem, you're giving out federal financial aid dollars inappropriately, and if the policy, of course, statewide, then that would likely potentially trigger additional audits. Either to Ben or Representative Gelsert, are we thinking that we create a contingency plan for these kids? Because that audit will immediately, for a small period of time in college, worked in the financial aid office, but I imagine that audit will immediately trigger a halt of all funding and an immediate, if kids are in the process of a new term or what have you, if they're a low-income child particularly, really stop that child's academic progress, or that student's academic progress. So are we thinking of what a backup plan looks like should an audit come in and trigger a yanking of those funds for those kids? Because, I'd hate to have us be outside of a time in a legislative session where we can do anything about it if that audit came and we're not in session and we can't kind of quickly try to find a way to solve that problem. And I really don't feel like leaving the community colleges to try to solve that on their own. And as I understand it, this could potentially affect 800 kids a year. So are we thinking that we have a backup plan?
I have an answer, but do you want to go first?
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish. So I've not been involved in any discussions about a backup plan, if you will. Two things to say about it. One, I would hope that the state would make a forceful and vigorous defense of the colleges that have acted under this determination to award these students who, in virtually every respect, are, indistinguishable from other students who have received high school diplomas. So number one, I hope that would be true. And number two, I think the level of concern that your question expresses for how students would be impacted in the case that things went awry is appropriate. And I take your question as a sort of suggestion and direction to be thinking along those lines. And so, no, there isn't a backup plan today. I would start with the defense. But, yes, it should be on the back of our minds.
And if I may just quickly, I do think one thing that might help moving forward is, federal financial aid is a relationship between the institution giving it and between the federal government. Mm-hmm. And so you're right. I mean, so they would be on the hook. And I think part of this has been probably a communication where, if there's a further conversation happening at the federal level that, have some of the folks who are in that relationship between the feds and the institution involved in the conversation, so they're hearing it too, so that they can go back to their mm-hmm. colleagues and say, yes, we were in a conversation with the Department of Education and they're saying this is okay. I think maybe including some of the post-secondary folks who are one side of that relationship in some of these conversations going on between the state and the federal level might help to get the word out and kind of help to make that be a bit more collaborative.
And I think just following up on that answer, I think the point is the state moving forward, acting in good faith with very clear statements with multiple different representatives of the state of Oregon, talking with them about this. Senator Merkley's office sitting in that room, receiving the same email, pointing to the same document about the state determining the high school graduation requirement. And the change that this really makes on the federal financial aid form, it asks, have you received a high school diploma? And the question is, can the student check yes? That's really the answer that's being the issue that's being addressed.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
And I do appreciate that. There are other conversations outside of our committee where we've received federal funds and the federal government's talking about coming back to the state if we didn't use them appropriately. So that question always lurks, and my concern is if we move forward under this premise, how far, you know, and maybe John answers this question, or maybe we need to go get the answer, but how far back can the federal government come back and reach for those funds? Because if you're talking about $800 a year or 800 students a year, and now you've got kids 3 years into this decision, we're talking about a lot of kids and a lot of Pell Grants and things that have gone out. And my concern is if they reach back and say, well, there is no kind of statute of limitations on that, we're talking about potentially a significant chunk of money that community colleges could be on the hook for. And I just want to make sure that we have that information before we... I agree with the policy, too. I want to make sure kids get financial aid. But I just want to make sure that we don't put all of that onto the community colleges and suddenly we're 5 years down the road and Uncle Sam comes and says, you weren't doing that the right way, and we were going to go back and collect on all of these kids that you gave money to, that they would have some reach. And that bothers me.
And Chair Gelser, members of the committee, just to clarify, or Representative Parrish, I would have to go back and look. When a college gets audited on their financial aid by the Department of Education, I believe there is a finite window. I don't think they could go back 20 years.
Sure.
And the number I had in my head was 5 years, but I'd have to go back and look and ask some of my colleagues at the campuses what that window can be. But I'm fairly sure it's not infinite.
No, I don't think it's infinite, but I do think having done, you know, like the school lunch program, there is a window that they can go back in and have that reach. So when you're talking 800 kids over 5 years, you know, or other kids who are in that process, it could be a significant number if we're not careful.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I think if we can get there, it's going to open up phenomenal opportunity to a lot of Oregon students, and that's a good thing. I I'm going to say this maybe a little differently and stronger than my two colleagues before me, but basically the same thing. Whatever we decide and whatever rule, it needs to be the right answer, because I don't want to hear of students, higher ed institutions, or the taxpayers being on the hook for anything for the feds coming back. I think that's going to be critical before we do this and open the gate. We've got to know what we're doing and that we're going to hold everybody harmless.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for anybody in the queue?
Well, thank you, and thank you again for all of your assistance with this. I got a phone call the other day from a student in Rogue Community College who had been once and was sent away. He went a second time, and he was sent away, and he went the third time, and his financial aid, he applied. He was found appropriate for his loan and his grant, and he's going to be able to go to school. And the number of phone calls and emails on this issue has really been overwhelming. There's a lot of kids for whom the door to post-secondary education and training was shut, not just for a four-year degree or a two-year degree, culinary arts, welding. These are kids that are going to be able to get jobs and support themselves, and I know it's a change, and I appreciate the financial aid directors wanting to be sure that kids don't get hit on the back end, but I think that the U.S. Department of Ed has been pretty consistent and clear in those communications, and we're going to have more self-sufficient Oregonians as a result of that, I think. Thank you very much. Are you raising your hand, or are you just lifting your pen?
I'm lifting my pen.
Okay.
It's a very nice pen.
It is a very fine pen. All right. So we're closing the informational meeting on financial aid for students with modified and extended diplomas and opening up an informational hearing on Common Core standards and smarter balanced testing implementation. And first, I would invite Dr. Nancy Golden and Rob Saxton.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. Enjoy the rest of the day at your Capitol.
You want to sit over here?
Okay. Okay, great. That's great. And we did get an answer. We will flip those last two agenda items.
Thank you.
All right. Great. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gelser, member of the committees for the record. I'm Nancy Golden, and I'm the Chief Education Officer.
And Representative Gelser, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction for Oregon. And we're here today to talk about the Common Core Standards and then also a little bit about the assessment that goes along with the Common Core Standards, the Smarter Balanced Assessment. So one of the first things that I wanted to talk about today, I'll see if we're not up on the screen. I'll keep going though, but one of the first things I wanted to talk today just a little bit would be just about standards in the state of Oregon, a little bit historically about standards in the state of Oregon. So Oregon has had standards since 1995. There were other things before that that were just like standards, but they didn't call them standards. The very first standard showed up in 1995, and over time the standards have changed. And so as things have changed, about every 5 to 7 years, the State Board has adopted a new set of standards. And when that new set of standards is adopted, then people work to align what they're teaching to that new set of standards. And so there was a new set of English standards, English language arts, I believe, in 1995, and then again in about 2002, and then the Common Core that was adopted by the State Board in 2010. The purpose of the Common Core standards is to ensure that when students move through the education system and graduate, that they've mastered a set of college and career ready standards. That as they exit the K-12 system, that they're ready to be successful in the next steps of their life. And so really, the very first part of identifying what these standards are is to know or to understand what it is that we would consider a set of college and career-ready knowledge and skills. And to say that's what we want to have students have mastered by the time they're a senior in high school or as they're leaving their senior year in high school. And then to really back map what knowledge and skills would they need to learn in each grade along the continuum so that we're sure that as they move through from really preschool all the way through the system in first grade, second grade, third grade, that there is a vertical articulation of knowledge and skills that's built into a system that says, this is what we want students to learn in third grade. This is what we want to learn in fifth grade. This is what we want to learn in seventh grade. And so on as they move up through the years so that they have an opportunity to actually master the content and skills and the knowledge base that they need in order to graduate college and career ready. The Common Core standards really came about as the result of two different groups that initially came together. One is the Council of Chief State School Officers, which is other people who sit in a position similar to mine in each of the 50 states, and then the National Governors Association. And their Council of Chief State School Officers, some of the officers came together and began to talk about the fact that they were getting ready to adopt new English language standards, English standards across multiple states, and said, I don't understand why we have to do this on a state-by-state basis. It would make sense to bring together the best expertise and knowledge that we have around this set of standards in multiple states and see if we couldn't have something that multiple states would adopt. And it would give us an opportunity to bring better expertise to the table, have a richer discussion, and make sure that we end up with a really good set of standards. And the National Governors Association joined in that conversation, and multiple states came together in 2008 and 2009 and developed the Common Core standards. They are just in two subjects, just in English language arts and in math. They've been adopted by individual states, so states have the option to adopt these standards or to not adopt these standards. And the State Board of Oregon actually did adopt these standards in 2010. At the time, the State Board, because I was around it, I can remember back, at the time the State Board was looking at the Common Core State Standards and having a discussion about whether or not Oregon ought to adopt them, if they should adopt them for Oregon. And the Superintendent's Vision and Policy Group had come together and had issued a statement that they believed that Oregon should adopt the Common Core State Standard and encourage the State Board to do that. And at that time, the State Board then did adopt those standards.
So we wanted to take just a few moments to take a look at the Common Core State Standards and then look at what was happening in 2009 with the Oregon State Standards for Language Arts and talk a little bit about what's the distinction. And when Rob says college and career ready, you know, one thing we know is that a lot of times we talk to our business people, our people who hire students out of college or community colleges or some out of high school, and a lot of times we hear that there's a skill set they're missing. And part of what the Common Core State Standards did was trying to teach some of these skills. So what you'll see on the Common Core Standard side in the first and last example, you'll see that what they do compared to what we had previously is there's more about applying knowledge, higher level of rigor, and deeper depth of knowledge. So going deeper on fewer things as opposed to broader on a lot of things. What you'll see in the middle one, as you compare them, is that there's a lot more with the Common Core standards that asks us for explanations, generalization, so skills that would really be used in college and beyond. If you look at the next one, the fifth grade English language standards, what you're going to see is more complexity focused on understanding relationships, comparing and contrasting, and this would be in relationship to more than one task. So that gives you a comparison of what was happening before and what happens with the Common Core standards.
So I wanted to talk just a little bit about, since it's in two subject areas, we wanted to talk about both English and then also the math set of standards. And so what you'll see on this list is fifth grade math overview. And so there are components that are about operations in algebra, number operations in base 10, number and operations around fractions, measurement and data, and geometry. It's the kind of thing that if you were going to say, what is it I want my fifth grader to know, if I was going to identify the kinds of skill sets that I'd want them to know in math, what would I say it is? And so it really is a very specific listing about here are the things that we want fifth graders to know. I'll direct your eyes to the second one down, which is number and operations in base 10. So it's about understanding a place value system and perform multi-digit whole numbers with decimals to hundreds. And I chose that one because on the next slide, what I wanted to show you is something similar to the comparison that Nancy showed between in English language arts, and direct your eyes to the second one. It really says recognize that in a multi-digit number, a digit in one place represents 10 times as much as it represents to the place to its right and one-tenth of what it represents in the place to its left. So if we had a three-digit number, 265, that the 6 in the 265 would represent how many sets of 10 there are, 6 sets of 10 for 60. And that it would be 10 times as much as the number to the right and a tenth of the number to the left, which would be in the hundredth spot. So it's that kind of math representation. And what we tried to do is look at what are the differences between what's in the Common Core as compared to what there were in the old Oregon standards, so that we have kind of this movement from one to the other so that people are aware of where that is, and that we provided these for our teachers in the state. And so you can see that on the top one, this is new content that had previously been covered in the sixth grade, and in the second one, there's some work that's been done in this in Oregon standards in fourth grade, but it's not as deep as what's contained in this new set of knowledge in math for the fifth grade standard.
Are you by any chance a math teacher?
Yes, I was a math teacher, and if you really got me going, I'd have to get my my whiteboard out and start going crazy on tenths and hundredths. But anyway, implementation status. So I would tell you that truly the implementation status is in different places in different districts. I was really heartened. This may be the first but not the last time that you'll hear somebody say something like this, but we recently, in fact today, released the results of the TEL survey, the Teaching, Empowering, Leading, and Learning survey. So it's a survey that educators across the state took. And one of the questions that was contained in that survey was, does the curriculum taught in this school align with the Common Core standards? And on that survey, 79.9% of the teachers in the state of Oregon answered yes. To be honest with you, I was a little bit surprised by that really virtually 80% of teachers said our curricula is aligned to the Common Core standards in the state of Oregon. Just got that result back. Because I do think it is variable by district. There are some districts that when the state board adopted this in 2010, immediately went to work on aligning what teachers were teaching to the Common Core set of standards. The Umatilla School District, for example, has had this in place since early 2011. There are other districts that's been a little more spotty. In my old district, Tigard High was on top of this immediately, Tualatin High, because they were working on some other things. I gave them a little space in order to get aligned to that. But so it is variable both by district and across the state. But these survey results tell me that it's much further along than I probably appreciated. I do think there's a significant push as we arrive into 2015 because for the first time there's an assessment that waits in the spring of 2015 that's aligned to the Common Core. So the OAKS that we give now, it's aligned to our old set of standards, the standards that we had previous to 2010. And so the issue that we have right now is we have teachers and districts that are doing what they've been asked to do, which is to adopt the Common Core and have teachers teach to that set of knowledge in each grade level. And then we have a test that was written to the old standards that we had adopted in the state prior to 2009. And there's a disconnect between those two. With the Smarter Balanced Assessment, it's a test that's written to this new set of standards. And so there will be a test that compares this set of standards for the first time in the spring of 2015. And because those two things are lining up, it has a lot of folks' attention right now to make sure that if we're going to be teaching, that we're teaching to this set of standards. The strategic initiative, the legislature funded about a combined $11 million out of the strategic initiatives out of the 2013 session to offer a train-the-trainer model to educators across the state. The Department of Education, Stand for Children, OEA, and COSA collectively delivered workshops across the state. We have one more day left this summer, but there were 5 days in various regions across the state. 1,000 educators came to those trainings, about 250 in four different training sites, if I recall correctly, and received training about the Common Core and its implementation. And then districts received resources at about $9.20 per student so that when these people went back to their district, they could work with teachers in their own district to do training about the Common Core. And so you can see that at $9.20 per student, with a minimum of $1,000 for really, really small districts, large districts receive somewhere in the neighborhood of $400,000. Medium districts, about $150,000, and small districts from $1,000 to $10,000. Corvallis was $63,000. I just happened to pick that one because it seemed like a good one to pick. Woodburn, $67,000. Lebanon, $45,000. North Santiam, $25,000. David Douglas, $110,000. So those are the dollars that districts received through this initiative so that these trainers could go back and work with teachers in their own district on the training initiative. I would say also that districts themselves, since 2010, have been working on this to varying degrees, on making sure that people know what the Common Core standards are and that the material, the content, the teachers are teaching are aligned to that. It's really important for us to keep a couple different things separate. So these standards are just that, a set of standards. There's nothing magical about them except that they're aligned to college and career readiness. We've had standards for a long time in Oregon. Curriculum are the materials that are developed, the teachers use, and that local boards have the authority, complete authority, to select in order to have teachers work towards teaching to those standards. So the curricula is a local matter, how the teaching gets done. This is the what we're going to teach to, the how is the curriculum, and then the assessment is a really high-stakes accountability summative assessment, the Smarter Balanced, to measure how well students are doing against this set of standards.
So we had some questions that were actually given to us because there were some questions that the representatives here had, and so I wanted to talk a little bit about those. And the first one is, will the Common Core State Standards help us meet the 40-40-20 goals? And first of all, 40-40-20 goals are about career and college ready. If these standards were designed down from what career and college ready skills are, I believe they will do that. But I think the other thing for to know is that Common Core State Standards can't be in isolation from the other things we're working on. So we know that they're articulated across the grade levels, but we're also working on key places on the continuum as part of the Oregon Education Investment Board, like students coming to school ready to learn, reading by third grade level. So having the Common Core State Standards, which clearly articulate the college and career standards, along with the other things we're doing, starting at a very early age to get students successful, I think they really do work together. The second question, does it improve our graduation rate? Well, I think if you're a child who moves to multiple schools, and many of our children do move to multiple schools, if you know every school has the same standards, you're not moving into schools or districts that have a different set of standards. We also have students who move from state to state who, if they're using Common Core standards, would have more consistency in that way. Can they reduce developmental remediation and remedial education? I appreciate these questions because we certainly believe they can and want them too. And again, because these are designed from what are college and career standards, we have much more sense of as people in 0 to K-12 is trying to meet those standards so students will go into college and not need developmental or remedial education. Many of our community colleges are working on taking the Common Core state standards from K-12 and then saying, if this is what you have in K-12, what do you have, in community colleges and four-year colleges? So there's certainly a movement around alignment with that. Can it create good citizens? Well, I think when we talked about the skills of being able to apply, being able to analyze, those are things that I think as citizens, that every time we're making a decision, we need to have those critical skills to help us think through and make the right decision. So we think that is true. Will it improve absenteeism? Well, when you apply things in school, and sometimes the content is much richer when you learn something from a textbook but you're not applying it, the fun part comes in applying. So, for example, you can learn a lot of math, but when you're in a robotics team where you're building a robot who can do a bunch of things and you're competing in the state, you're really applying those math skills in a way that could be much more engaging. So I think in that sense, it could improve absenteeism. I obviously think there's other issues we have to work on in a state to improve absenteeism, too. But can it improve parent involvement? Well, again, I think if there's common standards, not only in a state, but in many states, it allows materials, parent engagement materials to be developed that we can borrow from a state that seems to have really good materials. We can develop our own materials, but if a parent moves again with their children from school to school, there'll be some consistency about the what, and I think parents will feel much more able to participate in helping their children. So I kind of moved to the – did you move to the next page when I did, or did you just move to the
– I was just waiting until you told me, Nancy.
But okay.
These sort of
right.
Series of answers.
Yeah, so those are kind of what I was saying in a more precise way. So
I think it is important to understand that it is just a set of standards. It isn't – there's no magical panacea here. Again, Oregon's had standards for a really long time. It is a standards that probably brought the biggest collection of – experts together that the nation has ever tried to bring together to try to identify a set of standards and think about what college and career ready is. What the federal government has said to us is, as a state, you're required to have a set of standards, and that set of standards must align to college and career readiness. What that set of standards is up to you, but they have to align to college and career readiness. And if you send us a set of standards, they need to align to college and career readiness. So in Oregon, we could decide that we're not going to have the Common Core, and the state board could make a decision to adopt a different set of standards, but they would need to align to college and career readiness indicators, and it would be a significant undertaking for us to put together what those standards look like. And the truth of the matter is, when we were done, I'm not sure that we could design a better set of standards, or that they would look much different than those that currently exist in the Common Core. We could call them uniquely Oregon, but I think that they would be almost identical. It would be a significant effort, not that that's a problem. I think that there would be some expense involved, and at the end of the day, I'm not sure if they would be as good as the set of standards that we have in front of us. In fact, I think they probably would not be. So one of the questions was, has there been enough implementation funding? Well, I'm trying to remember the last time somebody in education said there was enough funding, but there probably just is not ever enough. I will tell you that the federal government sends us Title IIA funds, and Title IIA funds can be used for one and only one purpose, educator training, and it's $21 million per year that's sent. And so every year, the Department of Education puts $21 million a year out to school districts with the sole purpose of educator training. And so there is a significant resource, and I know as a district superintendent, we use this resource around teacher training and educator training for the Common Core, and most districts have. Then we also have the strategic initiative, and then also there are district budgets. And as a district superintendent, I always had a decision to make. How am I going to use the scant or, you know, the careful resource that I have as a district to think about what it is that we're going to do? And at least some of those dollars need to go to educator training. And so I do think that districts do have a responsibility in this and have played that role in an important way, as sort of evidenced by the survey that results that I shared with you earlier today. So smarter balance status. So now I'm going to shift gears. I want to step away from the Common Core, and I want to really draw a hard line as much as you can between. That's a conversation about standards. Now I'm going to have a conversation about an assessment.
So could we pause to see if there's questions about the standards before we move to the assessment?
Absolutely.
Okay. Representative Springer, and then Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to both of you. Like probably everybody up here, I've heard lots about Common Core and lots of concerns. And so I keep trying to ferret through those pieces and find out what are real concerns and what those specific concerns are. And your slides touched on some of them, and the slides actually stirred some for me. So, Nancy, on your slide, you were talking about the benefits of, and I don't know what number it was.
Going deeper.
Yeah. No, we're there. So how will the standards help? And I'm assuming that is the Common Core standards, but we had standards before statewide. So a lot of the things that are bulleted there to be benefits of Common Core, would it be accurate to say they were also benefits attributable to the prior set of standards? Is that fair?
Representative Galser and Representative Springer, I think the difference is these are designed from career and college ready. So I think we had a set of standards, but not necessarily that we looked ahead to the next place students were going to go to say, do these standards really make it so when they get to community college, four-year college, or the world of work, they're going to be successful? I think that's the big difference with it. That's what the federal government's asking us to do. And to me, that, you know, I still feel as a K-12 superintendent, if I shook the hand of the students at graduation, that was a measure of all of our success in the district because they graduated. And now I realize, no, it's really when they graduate from college or they get back to us and say, I've got a job, I'm making a living for myself and my family. So that's the difference.
Can I follow up? Oh, thank you. Rob, it was the next slide, I think, that shorter one. That one there. So when it talks about, you talked about improving parental involvement and being able to communicate as the kids move around, and I'm thinking of a school in my district that has an extraordinarily high mobility rate, and it's tough for kids. But prior to Common Core, and of course now with Common Core, the fourth grade standard was the fourth grade standard, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that part has not changed with Common Core. It's the same with Common Core as it was before. We still had that continuity.
Chair Galser, Representative Springer, yes, we did. But I think the difference is it's sort of back when they were developed. Sometimes if more than one state is doing it, you get to benefit from the materials from all of the states. So getting materials so parents, so they're written in a way, often as educators, we don't write in a way parents really understand them. We use education language. We receive feedback about that, I think, often. And so to really bring the best minds from more than one state and shared resources around creating materials, that's where I really see the benefit.
And if I could, Chair Gelsman, Representative Springer, one of them is that we do have mobility from other states, and for the first time, with the number of states that have adopted the Common Core, students who move from Kentucky, for example, would have the same set of standards as students who currently exist in Oregon, and so that kind of mobility would create that sameness. Around resource, you know, textbooks have always written to a set of standards, and they've always written to the most populated states, Texas and California. And so in Oregon, we were always looking at this set of textbooks and trying to figure out which set of textbooks that align to the Texas standards most closely align to the Oregon standards or to the California standards most closely align.
True.
Textbook manufacturers now are looking at the Common Core and saying, how do we align this so it's the same? The other part is that there is a huge resource of material right now that's never existed before, because a teacher in Massachusetts who's been teaching to this set of standards for some time and has developed a really first-class lesson about one of the standards, has that online, is being built into a big bank of those kinds of things. Teachers in Oregon can look at that, vet it as to whether or not it's really a good lesson, and utilize it. And so there's a new kind of resource sharing that's different than we've ever seen before, and it's really rich.
Thank you. One more, may I?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for both of you for that answer. So I hear all sorts of reasons, as we all do, why Oregon chose Common Core. And I'm sure that some of those are accurate, some of those and most of those are not. What did Oregon receive from the federal government for adopting Common Core?
Yeah. Chair Gelzer, Representative Springer, great question. Thank you for asking it. Nothing is the answer. At one point in time, the federal government, and I do believe that this is where a lot of the sort of upset comes from, because USDOE said, if you want to apply for a Race to the Top grant, you need to tell us that you have adopted the Common Core. It really is about the only time where there's been a hard connection between dollars and the Common Core. And so they did that. Oregon applied, but had not yet adopted, but was in the process of thinking about adoption. Had we received Race to the Top, we would have had to have adopted because we received Race to the Top. We didn't receive Race to the Top grants, and yet the state board still moved forward with adoption. But there have been no dollars that have come to Oregon as a result of having adopted the Common Core. We must have a set of college and career ready standards, and we must have a summative assessment that assesses to those standards in order to receive federal funds. And those federal funds total $370 million a year, so about $750 million a biennia. And absent having those two things, we would lose those funds. Having college and career-ready standards and an assessment, a summative that tests against those standards, not specifically Common Core and not specifically Smarter Balance. That's just been our choice to meet that requirement.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we've got Representative Parrish in the queue, followed by Representative Reardon, Representative Gomberg, Representative Wismut. Anybody else want to get in the queue?
Probably.
Just I'm just going to go ahead and put you in, then Representative Huffman, Representative Fagan.
Okay, so I have a couple. And these are just things I hear, so I want to get them clarified so I have answers to go back to my constituents when they ask. So one of the questions I get a lot is, if the legislature didn't vote on Common Core, what gave the board the authority, or where in statute is it that they could make that change without a vote of the legislature, a representative government, or whatever? So that's the first one. We'll start there. And I've got like just two or three. There should be yes to no easy, hopefully, questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought there was going to be a second one.
Not related to that one.
Pause between questions.
Thank you for the pause. I appreciate that. I started writing my list just in case. Actually, yes, the legislature in statute has asked the state board to adopt standards. I can get you the statute number if you'd like. I don't have it with me right now, but I did take the time to look it up, and the legislature in statute has asked the state board to adopt standards.
Okay, follow up to that. So when we say that we said we want to have standards, which I don't disagree, we shouldn't have some standards, does that give the authority, though, to change standards with a vote of the board? Is that, do they allow for that, or do we have to come back to the legislature and say, ta-da, here's what we're doing?
Chair Gelzer, Representative Parrish, the authority to change standards has been granted, so the state board shall adopt standards.
So something you said, follow-up to a different question, something that you said in your presentation based on the survey of asking teachers, and 79% of teachers said that they felt like they were ready, the other 20 or so percent that kind of don't feel ready, did they give any indication of why or what they feel is missing from them being ready? And that would follow on to kind of the notion that a few weeks ago in the Oregonian, 2 weeks ago today actually in the Oregonian, an article about the teachers union saying they're not ready for this.
Chair Gelzer, Representative Parrish, so the teachers indicated that they felt like the curriculum at their school was aligned to the Common Core.
Aligned, okay. Yeah.
So, you know, that's a small nuance, but I'm sure that the survey people would tell me you better say that, Rob. So there's that, and it did not give an indication about the other 20% of teachers within the survey results. I can tell you that on the latest national survey, and it's a little bit old, so it's the fall of 2013, teachers across the nation indicate, and this is a survey that was conducted by NEA, that 75% of teachers are in favor of the Common Core. Now that's a little bit old, and so those you know feelings change over time, but it is a data point that I have.
And that's the standards, not necessarily the assessment.
Correct, the standards. And what the, if I understand it correctly, what the OEA Representative Council said was that they wanted to suspend the Smarter Balanced Assessment until such time as teachers across the state felt like they were ready to implement the Common Core standards.
Okay, follow up. So next year we switch. My kids all just got done doing the Oaks test. Next year we switch, and if the concern from parents that I hear is that if they take this test and suddenly their kids fail this new type of assessment.
Can we wait for the assessment till the assessment?
Okay.
Because we're going to divide
those. I'll wait. The last piece, though, is in the testing, and maybe that is the next question, too. The other big concern I hear is the privacy of the data in the testing. And so wherever that's appropriate for you to speak to it, I would like to hear about.
So why don't we pull that back up into the into the assessment part? Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. And also, I think on the survey part, I think, Hannah, are you going to address some of the survey teacher
Yes.
teacher positions on things in your presentation? Okay, great. So just for others and the other questions that are coming up. Representative Parrish, do you have more?
Nope.
Okay. Representative Reardon.
I need to pass because I'm ahead of the
All
presentation.
Right. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Golden, Mr. Saxon, thank you very much. I have an essay question for you, if I could. I go out into the schools, and when I talk to the kids, they talk about the test. They talk about the pressure of the test, the time preparing for the test, teaching for the test. I was coming back to this, though.
Back to the standards? Okay.
Yes. You've been kind enough to talk to us about how the standards will help. And in the interest of a balanced presentation, I'd like you to talk to us a little bit about how the standards are going to hurt. I'm particularly interested in the amount of time that we're taking, not only for the test itself, but for preparing for the test in a context where we're already 3 weeks behind the national average in the number of teaching days. I'm interested in how the tests will affect our education environment when we expect that two-thirds of our kids are going to fail those tests, and what's the message there? And then finally, how are these tests going to hurt if, in fact, they are accountability devices rather than personal improvement devices? That's my essay question. If we're going to talk about how they're going to help, tell us also, in all fairness, how they're going to hurt.
Sure. Chair Gelser, Representative Gomberg. Well, that's an interesting question. So I heard a fair amount about the assessment. So I do want to talk about something that's different than the assessment specifically, but a little bit about assessment. So in Oregon, for the last, 10, 12, 15 years, however long we've given the Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills, for some reason, we decided that we were going to give that assessment three times. And when I tell other states in the nation that our test window in Oregon opened in November and closed in May, and that students could take the state accountability assessment three times, they laugh out loud about that. And it really has not been appropriate. There really are three different kinds of assessments that we think about giving in a classroom. One is just a really quick one where a teacher figures out what people know and don't know so that they can alter their instruction. There's one that's sort of interim, so it's along the way, like a chapter test, we would call it. The way when I was a kid, we would have called it a chapter test, or when I first taught, a chapter test, that tells us, are they learning what we want them to know, and is it likely that they'll have mastered this by the time we get to the end of the year? And then the last one is a summative assessment. It's a big kind of end-of-the-year test about what did you learn and what did you hang on to over time. Well, the test that I'm talking about, that we're talking about here, is that. And what we did in Oregon is we gave the summative assessment three different times, and then we tried to use it as a predictor of whether or not students would eventually pass the test or not. So a student took the test, and the computer lab was tied up in November for several weeks as everybody ran through the test, and we looked at the results, and we said, did students pass or not? If they passed, they may not need to take it again, but if they only passed with the meets, maybe they could exceed. And so let's give it to them again and see if they can exceed. And there also was an accountability system that made exceed better than just meets. And then we also assigned maybe some interventions because the student wasn't as far along as we wanted them to be. And then we gave it again in February and did the same thing, and then we gave it again. And the problem with that is it was over-testing. It wasn't an appropriate use of a summative test. And we got into this thing where, you know, the test became about teaching to it, looking at it, thinking about it, and on top of it, it's a multiple choice test. As a teacher, when I gave a test, the worst test I could give a student was a multiple choice test. It didn't tell me very much about what they really knew, what they really had mastered, and what they understood. In fact, if I gave it a multiple choice test, it should only be because I was terribly pressed for time or the material was really light memorization kinds of materials. So the assessment that we're giving looks different than that, and the instruction that we're giving looks different than that. I do worry sometimes that we have an extremely keen focus, if we're going to look for what's a negative, on English language arts and math, because they are the two major components of the assessment. And so I worry about that, and I think it is problematic. I think it's problematic when somebody teaches to a test, especially if it's a crummy test. If it's a really good test, one that asks deep questions and asks me to summarize and think deeply, to think about past knowledge and to tie different components together and really demonstrate my knowledge, I'm not as concerned about teaching to that. If I teach to the standards that I want to teach to, and then the test really does a good job of assessing against those, that's a good thing. If I overemphasize it or if I try to game it, that's a bad thing. If I spend a lot of time teaching test-taking skills, that's a bad thing. And so those are some of the components of it. You know, I've talked to some different superintendents in the state and some different people who say, we think that this assessment is one where you can be more proud of your instruction if you're teaching someone to the test. That's a better thing, but it's not perfect. And I do worry about the overemphasis on just two subject areas.
Great, thank you. Representative Wisnett, do you have a question about the standards?
About money.
About money. Money.
Thank you, Dr. Sexton and Dr. Golden, for your testimony. I had put on the record that I'm a little disappointed that the legislature was not involved in the board's decision before we went in this thing full speed, especially with the change in how education is organized in the state of Oregon right now, whether the board had that decision or not. And I say that as a veteran of CAM and SIM and how the legislature was involved in that. And I think we're going to be involved in this. Also, it would have been nice, Dr. Saxon talked about that the race to the top, because we thought we've heard from our constituents, yes, it was about $370 million. That's why we rushed to do this. And I take your report as being factual. But it's still a lot of money. The federal government, to make this work, does not have assurance that they can continue to do it. We talk about how the 11 million strategic initiative is a one-time, or is that continuous, I guess is my question. And you totaled that out as $9.20 ADM weighted. That's a lot of money to do this. Could they spend otherwise? So I don't know if there's a question in that other than is the 11 million, is that a one-time?
Yes, Chair Gelser, Representative Wisnett, the $11 million was one time over the course of the biennium, so it's a two-year process with 5 days this year and 5 days next year on the train, and the model, and then it's up to districts to think about their allocation of resource and how they use that. In the past, when Oregon has adopted new standards, there's been some support to help people align to the new standards, but I don't think that we've ever seen this level of support. This was two standards in at sort of one time, and it's a little more intensive on the move from the old standards to these standards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions.
Yes.
Both brief, I think. So, Rob, what you were saying about curriculum, if a parent has questions or frustrations with what their student is being taught, and I gave you the example of something I had read in an email sent to me that was supposedly quoting from a teacher's book that had misquoted the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and it had also portrayed the Bill of Rights as a fluid, flexible document that needs to be revisited by citizens from time to time. So if parents find problems like that in their students' curriculum, they need to go to their school board in their district and talk to them about what's being taught. Is that what you were saying? Because
the individual district is responsible for curriculum content?
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, precisely correct, yes.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to get that on the record.
No, one thing I could add to that is every board should have a process. It's an appeal process that if a parent has a concern, I know as being a board member, you probably had this, about a textbook, that there's a process so they get a fair hearing around it. It's a multi-step process.
Okay, great. Question number two. Because it seems like I've been here 7 years, and we've dealt with it a lot. And one of my questions was alignment with one of the purposes is for the Common Core State Standards to prepare a student to be college ready. And I don't know. I mean, I've checked around, and I haven't heard. I think they are now, and this is what I want to verify, that higher ed has been brought into the process. They're familiar with the standards, and they're good with it, because it kind of goes back to the remediation problem. And we seem to always stub our toe in Oregon on alignment. And I'm always hearing from higher ed that, no, we weren't asked, and K-12's going on teaching it anyway.
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, yes, higher ed has been very much brought in, and one of the things that's nice about this idea about a common set of standards is that it isn't just Oregon higher ed, although Oregon higher ed has been tied in very nicely, and there's been a very specific process about what that alignment looks like, and even what would the results of the assessment mean to higher ed within the state of Oregon. So is there something about what a student would achieve on the Smarter Balanced assessment or whatever assessment we were going to use, but specifically Smarter Balanced, that would say something or communicate something to higher ed? They're about to come out with their sort of determination or recommendations around that, and we continue to work to articulate that. The other component of it is that as we talk about this nationally, I do think that there'll be real clear implications about what a student does in Oregon and their ability to gain entrance to a college in California, Idaho, Maine, what have you, because there'll be a more common understanding about what these kinds of outcomes mean than we've ever had on a national basis, as compared to somebody trying to decipher, well, what does that mean in Oregon? All of the conversation that we had earlier about modified diploma.
Thank you.
Thank you. Assessment.
Okay.
And we do have another half of this program. I'm just for all of us as we're thinking about time. So OEA is going to give a presentation, and then we have two more agenda items.
So we'll try to be quick and concise here if we can. So the Smarter Balance, just as, status-wise, we gave a pilot assessment in the spring of 2013, then a field test this spring that went from March to June, so a much shorter test window. It will be an assessment that would just be given once. There have been over 10 million field tests across the continuum, actually about 11.5 million different tests now across the nation that have been given in the field test this spring. In Oregon, there were over 21,000 tests from 221 schools. California alone, because California did all smarter this spring, 8.5 million tests delivered. And it really was a question of, is this system going to stand up? Is it going to work? They needed to field test it on a big scale, and they did that. And we have a contract with the provider to provide Smarter Balanced. It's the same provider that provided us with OAKS, just on the delivery mechanism, and it's working for us in the state. And we would deliver this in the spring of 2015.
So we wanted to point out to you really what are the differences. So if you look at what's happening in 2013 and 2014 and what's going to happen in 2014 and 15 and beyond, what you really see is there are two tests that are different. And it's what Rob talked about. It's the Smarter Balanced Language Arts and the Smarter Balanced Math, but the rest of the assessments will remain the same. And then, and Rob talked about this a little bit when he was, when we were doing our essay, which was, if you think about teaching to a test, one key question is, I mean, we don't think you should teach your test, you teach the standards, one issue is the quality of the test. And what you look at, this test has actually selected responses. These are probably more like you would have seen on our OAKS tests, where There's a broad range of content. There's a question. You have to answer it a certain way. And we don't know why it was answered that way. We don't know the student's thinking behind it. It's just a multiple choice. Constructed response is much more like the essay, where you get to do a little bit more, that you generate a response as opposed to selecting a response. Multiple choice as opposed to I write my answer so you can see my thinking. And then the performance task is the ultimate experience, where you really perform tasks that demonstrate you've really integrated all of the knowledge that you've gotten up to that point, that is much more applied. Certainly, we don't see either the last two on the current test.
The other part of this is that selected response can be machine scored, but constructed and performance tasks have to be human scored. It's just too detailed to not do that. It's why it's a little more expensive assessment. Graduation policy, so people have asked about this a lot. So there are two parts of this. At the national level, the passing rate, the passing level for Smarter Balanced will be set at the NAEP or at the NAEP level, the National Assessment of Education Progress level, which is kind of the international benchmark level. It's a higher standard than what the old OAKS standards was. But our graduation standard in the state of Oregon is a 236 on the OAKS. And so what we will do is a study to correlate those two scores so that a 236 on OAKS will equal a score on Smarter Balanced. And if you meet that score, then you have met the Oregon Essential Skill. And you have to meet the essential skills in reading, math, and writing in order to earn an Oregon diploma. And so it will be at the same level. So sometimes we talk about what percentage of students are going to pass the Smarter Balanced test. We expect the same number of students to be able to demonstrate the essential skills, because we're going to make a comparison study between the two tests. We would expect that meeting the NAEP level will be a much lower rate than that. And so there'll be sort of two levels of I passed. One that would be set to the Oregon Diploma Standard, and one that would be set against the national standard, the NAEP comparator.
So this really just says that in the 2013, 2014 year, you can still, you're using OAKS, and then in 2014, 2015, it would be Smarter Balanced. And I think for 1 year, this is towards graduation, they could still use the OAKS, right, Rob?
Yes. For kids who are seniors who are juniors this year, they can still take the OAKS next year, in the winter of next year in 2014, to meet their essential skill. And that would be the last time that the OAKS would be offered. All juniors would take Smarter Balanced in the spring of 2015 then. Costs, so there is some additional cost to the Smarter Balanced assessment. When we look at extended response and the work samples, it's a more expensive assessment to deliver and to score. It's about $3.1 million more per year than what we currently spend on the OAKS. There have been lots of questions about the connection to teacher evaluation, and so I thought I would touch on that just really quickly. How the content gets taught is up to the teacher and or to the district. Certainly up to the teacher as they think about how they want to teach kids the standard, and then the curriculum up to the district and how that gets done. When we talk about connection to teacher evaluation, there are two parts of that. I want to talk to one specifically, which is called student learning and growth. So as part of our waiver process, we needed to design a new evaluation document or a new evaluation process for all teachers, and as part of Senate Bill 290 that the legislature passed. And so both of those require that there be a measure of student learning and growth that's built into the evaluation system. It's really important for us to sort of think about the difference between a student meeting a benchmark standard and student growth. So student growth is what did I know when I walked in the door versus how much did I know when I left. And so within the evaluation process, teachers are working to set goals around growth, that knowledge gain over the course of a given year. And there's multiple measures within the evaluation process, but this is one of them. And teachers set two growth goals for their students in every subject as part of our evaluation process. If you teach English Language Arts or math, you must use results from the summative assessment around growth to determine or to write your goal and determine your success on your goal. So it is a place where our assessment, our summative assessment, is tied into educator evaluation. It's not what percentage of my students met. It is compared to the previous year and this year, how much did my students grow? And the teacher writes that goal and sits down with their evaluator to determine that it's a healthy and appropriate goal. So it's not about the percentage. Because this is the first year, this spring would be the first year that we would do Smarter Balance, I have asked the federal government to disconnect this from this year's 2015's evaluation cycle, to not use Smarter Balance in evaluation, because it's new enough that I think it would be inappropriate to do that. I do think that the federal government will say yes to that request. They haven't responded yet. I really hope that we'd have a response by this week, next week at the latest, but I do think that they'll decouple those at least for the first year, for the delivery year of 2015. I doubt that they would want to move forward and disconnect that in 2016. So
the question asked is, has there been negative feedback? And I think you've mentioned much of it, and so I don't want to go over those again. But, yes, we have, like you, heard feedback. And then the next question is, has there been positive feedback? And we've articulated some of that, but these are the things about what is positive about that. And I won't go over it again. I'll just assume if you have questions about it, you'll ask us.
And that concludes our presentation. Thank you.
So I have a question from the point of view of the student. I happened to attend a meeting with my daughter, who's moving into high school, and the way that the school described this to her was that there was a new test that was coming, and it was going to be really hard, and she would only have one chance to take it in her junior year. And so she should try really hard to get a high OAKS score this spring. She left really stressed out about whether or not she was going to be able to graduate from high school. And some of the questions that she had that I couldn't answer, is it true that she only gets one chance over that entire high school career? And in terms of that NAEP score, that double score, when the student takes the test, will they be seeing both of those meets and not meets? Because the impact on a kid of getting back that you didn't meet, even if it's just a point, even if they're doing well in the class, is really devastating to the kids. So can you talk a little bit about how is this being communicated to kids, and do you get more than one try?
Yes, Chair
Gelser. And are they going to be told they're failing?
Right, Chair Gelser. A couple different parts. So for students, they get to take the assessment in their 11th grade year, and then there's an opportunity for them to take it again in their 12th grade year if they don't pass it in their 11th grade year, if they don't meet the essential skills. And so so the essential skills are basically a 236 in our current score, and there'll be an equivalency in reading, and a 236 in math. Those demonstrate the essential skill. And one way to demonstrate the essential skill in the state of Oregon is with this summative assessment. Students also have the ability or the opportunity to demonstrate the essential skill in multiple other assessments. So you can demonstrate it on the ACT, SAT, work keys. You can demonstrate it on the PSAT, I believe. Yes, you can. You can demonstrate it by classroom work samples. So there are multiple ways for students to demonstrate the essential skill besides just this assessment. In Oregon, the majority of students have demonstrated it by taking an assessment. And then, depending on the essential skill, other students have demonstrated it with classroom work samples the majority of the time. So about 90% of our students in reading have done it with the assessment, and then about 9% have done it with classroom work samples, for example.
So, Representative Gelser, another way that this could be presented to students are, we have a set of standards. We've been teaching them all along. This test that you're taking is aligned with the standards. So the work we've been doing is really going to help you in this test. And, and in addition, you have some other ways of demonstrating the knowledge you have. So take the test. Try your best. We know you will. But also know there's work samples and all the things that Rob said. So, I think that is part of our responsibility to work really, really hard with our districts around how to communicate it in a way that is clear, true, supportive and gives the options.
And I think that communication is really important, because for those kids who have become accustomed to being able to take a test up to three times, they already are not sleeping, not eating. I mean, they are so stressed out before they go in to take that Oaks test. To have it come down in your junior year to the time you go in and take this test and feel like, this is it, I might not graduate if I don't do well on this test, I think that is alarming to some of the students.
And Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I do need you to hear me say this about this assessment and the challenge of it, because I know that you hear a lot about it, and it's true. The first state that adopted the college and career ready standards and then delivered an assessment against those standards, I believe, was Kentucky. And the first year that Kentucky did that, about 37% of their students met the standard on their assessment. In the next year, they were about 44%. Last year, they were just at about 54%. And they predict that they'll be at about 60% this year, and that will continue to move up over time. And so that's not the kind of passing rates, if you will, that we currently have against the Oaks. Our passing rates are higher than that. Please remember, there's a disconnect between the essential skill demonstration, which is still set at a 236 regardless of test, which is about graduation, and passing the test at what is really a NAEP, a National Assessment of Education Progress equivalency. And that passing rate will be low, especially the first year that we give the assessment. And people will say, what happened? And it will be that it's a much more challenging set of content, and it's a much more challenging assessment.
And a different kind of assessment.
And a different kind of assessment. And it is true that in the first year that students take this, there will be a high rate of students who do not pass the assessment. I think over time it will go up. I worry about that and what that's going to look like, what the conversation looks like, how that feels, all those different components. I also worry about the fact that by the time we give this assessment for the first time, Kentucky predicts that over 70% of their students will pass the assessment. And we would predict that about 30-some to 40% of our students will pass the assessment. And our students are going to compete with their students mm-hmm. in college placement, in work readiness, and in the world of tomorrow. Mm-hmm. That concerns me. And so when I look at this and I think about how important is this, and do we need to really tilt at this, I think that in order for our kids whose zip code is going to be less important when it comes to success in the world than it ever has been in any time in history, we've got to do everything that we can to give them the advantage. They're not going to lose knowledge. They simply are going to run into a harder assessment.
Representative Spire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. You mentioned that, Rob, you said that juniors, and that really piqued my interest since I have one of them, and that they will have an opportunity in the winter of 2014.
Correct.
To take that. So I'm thinking about all of Austin's friends. That will be the last opportunity to take the Oaks and pass it?
Chair,
they will not have an opportunity in the spring?
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, yes. So students who are juniors this year that are taking the Oaks in the spring for essential skill demonstration will have another opportunity to take that assessment in the winter of, I think it is late 2014 or early 2015. I'm not sure if it's in December or January. And the reason that that's the last time it's given is that we have to get the results back if it's going to have any impact on whether or not they've demonstrated their essential skills for graduation. And districts have said to us, don't give it later than that, because we want the results back in time so that if they don't, we can really go to work on making sure that they have classroom opportunities to pass. Okay. And it doesn't do any good for you to give it later than that. And so that's what we've responded to.
That makes sense. Thank you. Representative Springer, and then Representative
Thank you. Rob, you had a slide up there. And frankly, I'll just, that one right there. I'll be very honest.
I didn't like that one either.
I'm really confused. So help me sort through this. So 236 is the magical number on the Oaks.
Yes.
And I heard you say that on the Smarter Balance that you will be looking at obtaining an equivalent number. My concern is we've adopted more robust standards and a more robust assessment tool. So are we going to pick a number that is reflective of that or still keeps us at what is the equivalent of 236 on the Oaks? Did I ask that clearly? Because I've been sitting here wrestling with this ever since that slide was up there.
Yes, Chair Gels, Representative Springer, I think so. If what I understand is that 236, the yellow bar,
yes,
is the bar that it will take for a student to demonstrate essential skill on any test in the state of Oregon. We have a graduation standard or an essential skill standard. It's a 236, and no matter what assessment students take, it needs to be equivalent to a 236 to demonstrate the essential skill. And that's what will be required to demonstrate the essential skill to earn an Oregon diploma. The other mark, the B, that would be what compares to the NAEP equivalent. And that will be sort of the national look on this assessment about what counts as passing. So you can meet the essential skill, but not pass the assessment at the higher NAEP level.
And I'm going to move us, because we're really running low on time. Representative Gomberg?
I'll be very quick, Madam Chair. Just a quick observation. Kentucky versus Oregon, a quick Google search confirms that they've got their kids in class 20 days more than we do each year.
We know how to take care of that.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So I want to go back to my questions from earlier, now that we're talking about testing. So when you're talking about, you know, potentially having this very low passing rate in our first few years, tell me how that's tied to the federal funding. If we're not meeting some kind of standard from them, what does that look like, the $370 million a year, whatever we're getting to do this? Interested still in the longitudinal data tracking of scores and kids, and what changes compared to the Oaks test? That's a concern that I've heard. You know, there's a lot of parents in the room today. I want to acknowledge the fact that they're here because they're frustrated about either what's going on in their own school districts or response at the local level. Not sure how we address that at some point in the future and giving parents an opportunity to come and share with the legislature why they are concerned. But I also want to understand, too, accommodations for kids with IEPs in this testing. If the testing's going to get a little more rigorous, how does that change for those kiddos who are on IEPs?
Federal government, what happens?
Oh, yes. Okay, thank you. Jared Gels, Representative Springer, or Parrish. So the federal question about funding and that kind of thing, the funds do not change based on how well or poorly we perform as a state in comparison. It is important to note that we have this designation of focus and priority schools in the state. That the federal government and part of our waiver have asked us to identify and support if there are schools who are performing at a low level. It will not create more focus and priority schools. Right now, the lowest 5% of performing schools are priority, no matter what assessment is taken. So if it's Oaks, it's the lowest 5% on that. If it's Smarter Balanced or Park or whatever assessment we use, it would be the lowest 5% on that. So it won't change sort of the distribution, if you will, of schools that are identified. When it comes to longitudinal data, one of the things that I said earlier was that we have the same delivery company, the same company that's actually delivering this through the computer as we had with Oaks, is going to also deliver Smarter Balanced. We have, we have a contract with that group about student information and that we own it, and only we own it as a state. And so it's the exact same company that does that will deliver Smarter Balance. There will be other delivery mechanisms for other states. We still have the same components within the contract with them about student information, that we own it and it's ours and it's only ours. We will not send information, student identifiable information, to the federal government. We take the results, we aggregate it, and we relay what our results are. So we say X percent of students met or X percent of students succeeded and so on, but we don't tell them anything about any individual student that's owned in Oregon and uniquely in Oregon. And so I think that's a really important part of what we're doing. So there'll be absolutely no change in the data management as compared to what we've had previously. And then lastly, IEPs. So right now, students who who have profound disabilities are able to take what's called an extended assessment. So they're able to take an assessment that's outside of this kind of assessment because it just wouldn't be appropriate. And so I believe that we still have the capacity to do that, and I'll double check on that. The other part is that within this particular assessment, there are many more accommodations that are built into the assessment than what we've ever been able to deliver on the part of Oaks, just because it's been a much greater development and it has a lot more detail to it. So, for example, there'll be places where you could click and actually have an explanation or a math problem laid out for you in sign language by a video, for example, as compared to what it's been, where you can do a hover over on some of the on the words, and it will tell you what those words are in multiple languages other than English. And so there are all kinds of accommodations like that that are built into the assessment mechanism that are way beyond what we've ever been able to actually deliver on the Oaks. It just is that it's a multiple state consortia. There are currently about 17 states in the consortia, and they had a lot of federal funding to develop the assessment.
And just the last piece, is about the parents, because I've got three kids. They're at very different stages. I've personally watched the curriculum change in my school district in the last 4 years. What one kid was doing, and now that kid who's now in fifth grade is the other one's getting ready to go to high school. I mean, I'm seeing those changes, and I know that there are frustration from parents in the communities, in this parents sitting in this room. What is the outlet? If they're not getting what they need at their local school district, and meeting those brick walls, and we do know that that happens out there in school districts at the local level, what is the outlet that ODE is doing to maybe help connect parents to the information to get the questions answered that they're seeking? And I think that's a fair. They're paying for it. Taxpayers are paying for this, and I think that making sure that parents feel looped in is really important. And so what's the effort from the department on that front if parents are reaching roadblocks in their own local school districts?
Right. Chair Gelser, Representative Parrish, I do think that if there are roadblocks at the local level, certainly coming to the state board is a viable and reasonable response. Also at the department, we're working very hard right now to try to communicate out as much information as we can. To be honest with you, typically it's on our website, or we communicate it out to school districts. We may need to think of another mechanism if it's not coming through school districts. We have formed a communication team with OEA, COSA, Chalkboard, STAND, and PTA. Where we've brought all their communication people together and other representatives together and talked about how do we make sure that we get out the word on this and communicate it as effectively as possible. And I would guess that we probably need to redouble those efforts, especially as we head into the next school year.
Can I follow up to that real fast? Is there a place where parents can opt into communication directly from ODE?
Chair Gelser, Representative Parrish, yes. Our communications person can be directly communicated with, of course, and I'm not going to be able to come up with her email off the top of my head, but we certainly can get that posted up on our website.
Newsletter or something would be great.
Yes.
So thank you.
I apologize for not having
that. Thank you. Do you have a brief question before we pop over?
I don't know how brief.
Yeah. Okay.
I've been waiting patiently in my
All right.
turn, so thank you. Thank you again for coming in. It's very helpful. One of the concerns I have in one of the districts that I represent, they have high levels of poverty, high levels of English second language, high percentage of children of color. I understand there could be some test bias against all of those classes. Could you give me your understanding on it?
Yes, Chair Gelser, Representative Reardon. It's a really hard question. If I was going to be, very blunt about it, I would say that I think that just about any test has some test bias that's built into it. Certainly, the developers of this assessment have worked as diligently as they know how to try to remove test bias from this, with the recognition that when we have standardized assessments, that there is test bias, and that they had an opportunity to develop a brand new assessment from the ground up, which is a really unusual opportunity that began about 4 years ago, and they had $185 million to do it. And so I think they've worked really hard at it. I just cannot tell you that it doesn't exist. I think that it probably does when we get right down into it. I would say that one of the things I like about this combination with the Common Core is that there is a set of standards that's expected for all students, different than maybe what we've had at times in the past. I've always worried that there are some students that we don't give access to the highest levels of content. And when you say, no, these are our standards and they're high standards, that it gives some students access to content who previously we thought maybe couldn't get there, and we've denied them that access when maybe they were completely capable, or I believe that they were completely capable. And so that's two different sides of the coin. One's testing, and the other one is standards, and I've said I want to keep those separate, but I've sort of woven them together in my answer.
And I apologize. You passed me a note, and for some reason I crossed you off the queue.
Well, no, I asked you to at one time.
Oh, okay.
So would we be able to monitor that possible bias over time so that we can make adjustments? Would that be part of the plan? Or
Chair Gellers, Representative Reardon, absolutely. That will be a big piece of the work that needs to be done. And the maintenance of this test now sits with UCLA and their research base called CREST. And they'll be sort of responsible for the maintenance of the assessment and continued development over time. And I know that they intend to do all kinds of research about it and work to improve on it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Hannah. Andrew. And should we keep the lights off? Are your slides up first?
Sure. That would be great.
Right. Thank you. And Nancy and Rob, thank you very much. That was a lot of questions. I appreciate your answering all of them.
Okay. Great. Great. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Hannah Vandering. I'm an elementary physical education teacher and president of the Oregon Education Association. And I want to thank you for the opportunity, and this is a topic that is key in the minds of not only parents and students, but educators across the state. We appreciate the opportunity to share some information from our members. We are extremely proud at OEA. Over the last couple of years, we've invested a great deal of our time, money, and energy into leading the profession. And we believe that when educators lead, students succeed. And we've done our work through the Center for Great Public Schools around professional growth and evaluation tools. We've been on the forefront. We've been proud to have administrators asked to join our training around the professional growth and evaluation tools. We've been working on the compacts to try to ensure that the compacts that were created were helpful in moving student achievement. We've been working on the Common Core for some time now, helping assist with training and giving our own. And we also, as Rob shared, the Tell Oregon survey. And it's exciting, I think, that all Oregonians, when they dig into the information that you're going to see in the Tell survey, it's an honest reflection of the teaching and learning conditions here in our schools that can help us come together as adults and make some decisions that will help us move forward. So today, what I'd like to do is talk to you a little bit about, it appears there's a problem with some slides. I see the second slide, but not the third.
This is the one I've sent.
Oh.
Well, we do have them, the committee has the slides in front of us.
Okay.
And then I think we'll want to get the complete one so we can get it in OLIS. But maybe while we're trying to get it up online, why don't we start moving through?
You bet. So as you were having your discussion, sometimes it's hard to separate the Common Core standards from the assessments, and that's something that we're trying really hard to do to make sure that we address the what our members are saying about the Common Core standards and the assessments. Our members support the Common Core standards, a majority of them with reservations. They support them, but as you will see, the reservations are around the testing and how that will impact the students that they work with every day. Our members want to ensure that the standards are implemented appropriately so that all students have a chance to be successful. And as Chair Gelser shared, you know, your daughter has one chance at the test. And we want to make sure that we implement any high-stakes standardized testing appropriately as we want all students to be successful and not be stressed out in our schools. We have the information that we have, and the slides that you'll see are a compilation of some information that we gathered from members through several different means. We had some focus groups that were done across the nation within the NEA family, and we had an OEA-specific focus group around Common Core standards. We also had a web-based survey that we had members complete, and we had a little over 330 members complete that survey. We also had, with the NEA group, we had 33 states that participated. I believe it's the largest state affiliate participation in a survey of any such kind, so we're excited to be able to share this information with you. We also, again, have the TELS survey that will that leads into some of the information that we have today and supports some of our findings. If we go to the Common Core standards and ask our members whether they support the Common Core standards, the 11% of our members support them without reservation. Only 11%. 49% support with reservations. So overall, a 60% support of the Common Core standards. And as you'll see, the reservations that they have are basically not being able to separate the standards from the testing. There are, on the slides that you'll see, let's see if we can get this up here. Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
Thank you for putting that up. Why our members support the Common Core standards is really important. It's what they see in the Common Core standards is that it promotes critical thinking and problem solving, and that's been missing in the bubble tests that we've been giving our students. So in order to take these standards and make sure that we're teaching those things that matter for our students and will help them be successful, it also has clear guidelines. They also have clear guidelines and goals, and they're more rigorous. And we're not afraid of rigorous as we're not afraid of accountability. We want to make sure that our students are prepared to be successful in whatever they choose to do. The next slide is going to show you why there are concerns about the Common Core standards. If you're not supportive, why not? And it is about too much emphasis on standardized tests.
Hey, Hannah,
yep.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Representative Springer had a quick question.
Yes.
So as I go through this document, and I will continue to go through it, and I hear things like, have you had the opportunity to inform your school? And then there's the three answers down here. Were the questions asked with the very same language?
Yes.
On the survey instrument as they are represented here?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Yes.
Sorry
You're
to
welcome.
Interrupt. It was
no
a
problem.
Clarifying point.
So the concerns with the Common Core standards were around the emphasis on standardized tests, and we've heard that for years, but also there is some concern about developmentally appropriate and making sure that the standards that we have in place really do reflect the learning that students should be incurring at each level. We have a lot of research that shows that standardized tests are not the measure that truly shows whether a student is successful, but we put so much emphasis on standardized tests, and the fear is that with these Common Core standards that we will continue that effort. I believe parents that we hear from, along with students who were around at the forums for the OEIB, emphasized the importance of taking that reliance on high-stakes standardized tests and putting that aside and putting it back our focus on student learning. The concerns that we see from our members around the implementation of the Common Core is around things being rushed, that we're not taking the time to make sure that we do it right. We're seeing money siphoned from things that we believe would be more advantageous for our students that are not being funded, and going back to the developmentally appropriate concern that members had shared. Members want to make sure they have the time, the resources, and the tools to prepare our students, and our students need the time and the instruction to prepare them to be successful with the new standards. As we talk about the implementation, and this is an Oregon specific, we've heard information about the implementation and the money that we've spent, but the feeling of educators across the state is that we haven't implemented appropriately and that we're not ready. There's
51% give a failing grade. So a 0 to 10 rating on the implementation, with a 10 being done well and a 0 being done not done well, this indicates that we believe that there's real flaws in the implementation. And I'll give a little more information on that so you can see what they're saying. And the key point is that people aren't being asked, or when they are being asked, they're not being heard about the implementation of the Common Core standards. As members have shared, they want to ensure that they have time to give input and that there's a collaborative, proactive plan in place that everyone is working together to ensure that our students are successful. And collaboration, as I shared earlier, some of the issues that we've been working on within OEA with our coalition partners, COSA, OSBA, the department, Chief Education Officer, it is about creating that culture of collaboration where we're all in this together, and that's what our members would like to see in this area. If we go into the disconnect about what educators believe they need and what they're being given, you're going to see some stark numbers here. The thing that people need to implement the Common Core standards correctly are time to prepare the new curriculum. You have to unfold the standards, and you have to create curriculum that really works. And you have to have assessments that are really aligned with those standards as you're trying to prepare your students. More time to collaborate with their peers to talk about what best practice is, what's working for them. It's amazing when you see a professional learning community working in a school, it's magic. And we can make that happen in schools when we allow educators that time and give them the professional discretion to have the conversations that they need to have around student learning. They also want to make sure that they have the classroom materials and textbooks that they need. What they're receiving is in-service. And if we were to look at the TEL survey data that's being released today and talk about professional development, there is a real disconnect between what's being offered and what educators believe they really need. And I think that's one of the areas that we're really hopeful for, moving the TELS data to make some policy decisions and some work with some districts around getting professional development right. The next information that you'll see is getting the implementation right, and it is putting the emphasis on student learning and not on testing. I shared earlier, I think one of the things that I hear over and over is it's the love of learning in our schools. It's been taken out because there's so much pressure put on administrators to make sure that they get that banner above their school that says they're doing well, on teachers to make sure that every student is being successful on those statewide high-stakes standardized tests, and then on the students who are coming to school on test days and getting ill or not coming to school because they don't want to take the test. So putting that love of learning, making sure that we have our students have a learning environment that prepares them to be successful. Looking at the financial resources that we need to invest to make sure that we get the implementation of the Common Core right, there are some huge issues around technology that we have. Talking with some of our districts, one plan was to shut down school for 2 weeks so the juniors could take the Smarter Balanced Assessment test. I believe that if you look at the third bullet here, you'll see that equity, making sure that all students have access, is a priority for educators as well. So we want to make sure the implementation is right. Now, overall, what educators, if you look at all of the information, all of the polling and the surveys, the focus groups that we had, what educators say they need to be successful are the opportunity to provide input. They want to help build the path to success in implementing the Common Core state standards. They need time for collaboration, to engage in conversations that will help them provide the best possible instruction. They need the tools and the relevant training to ensure that they're prepared to provide that quality instruction to each and every student that they work with. They also need to have the resources, the textbooks that are aligned. And I think one of the things that educators would really like to do is number five, and that's get the assessments right. We do classroom assessments every day. That's one of the things that educators, we created assessments. We're often challenged to say we don't want to be held accountable or we don't like tests. That's not the case. But what we want to do is we want to make sure that the assessments that we use are meaningful and that they provide students with immediate feedback about where they are and what they need to do to improve, and that they provide us as educators the information on where each student is and how we can move that move them on the continuum of learning. So this is an important piece moving forward, creating those assessments. And I'll mention here, OEA has a group of 16 members that are working together with the governor and Chief Education Officer Nancy Golden to create an assessment regimen that really meets the needs of students and that honors professional discretion of educators to use assessments appropriately. And we believe that will be extremely helpful in Oregon, leading the way to implementing the Common Core standards appropriately. So OEA, again, in working together to try to lead the way, and I'm going to skip because we had that one was off one. We just recently had our representative assembly in which we had over 650 OEA members come together that were elected by their colleagues to represent them to talk about the issues that are of utmost importance to education in Oregon. And we spent a great deal of time talking about the Common Core standards and assessments. And we actually took took action on several items that would help move us in leading the way. And the first one that is extremely important and that was overwhelmingly supported by our members was the call for a moratorium on the Smarter Balanced Assessment. We don't believe that we're ready to provide the assessment appropriately to students. We don't believe our students are ready for the assessment. Why would we spend millions of dollars implementing an assessment that 65% of our students will fail? There's a better way. There's a better method to use assessments appropriately in Oregon. And I understand that our Secretary Duncan would like to see standardized test scores for students. I'm not exactly sure how he uses that for Oregon students, but we're here to tell you as Oregon educators, there's a better path for us, and we're willing to lead the way and create that for all Oregon students. We also believe that we can work with parents and students to create those assessments, and we'll be reaching out through all means necessary to engage them in conversations about getting it right. We're going to ask all Oregon legislators and all of us, and as a member of the OEIB, I look forward to taking the Smarter Balanced Assessment. I think it's important if as adults we're saying this is a good thing for our students to be tested on, then we should feel what they feel. And the use of high-stakes tests in our schools right now is a detriment to public education, the way we're using it. We believe that we can use assessments in a different way that will really guide instruction. So we're going to invite you. We hope that you will join us in taking that assessment, and we'll give you an opportunity to give us feedback about how that felt and what you learned from that experience of taking the Smarter Balanced Assessment.
Well, Hannah, when last year, Representative Springer and I asked to take the OAKS, and we did. It was a great experience. Learned a lot. So when will this occur? I would love to do it.
Yeah, we'll have invitations out before the start of the school year. We're working on that and trying to make sure we have everything set so it'll be real easy for people to log on and take the assessment.
I am busy that day.
Yeah.
I'm already.
I do recall a certain amount of test anxiety last year when we talked about this. But it's
yes. It is, you know, it's an interesting conversation when you talk with people about tests and how it personally impacts them. There are other means to determine whether a student is going to be successful and share with them how they're doing. We're also supporting the call for congressional hearings on the misuse of high-stakes standardized testing. And then we're asking that really when we look at testing programs, they should be created by educators instead of for-profit There's a lot of money that is being made off of high-stakes standardized tests that we don't believe is helping our students. So our proactive campaign, and you have a copy of our priority action document that we're extremely proud of at OEA. It is about us providing the leadership to make sure that we get it right in implementing the Common Core standards and using assessments. So the first couple areas are around supporting and empowering educators and students in the transition to the Common Core standards. There's a lot of professional learning that needs to take place in order for us to be successful. So one of our first priorities is to ensure that we have that time. Time for instructional practice learning that meets the needs of all students in our schools. We've talked a lot about equity in Oregon. We've had the Oregon Leadership Network, which I really support the work that's been going on, and OEA is very supportive of that. But we talk a lot about it, and then when it comes time to make decisions at the state and district level, we often forget that each and every student deserves a quality education, and there are bias in the tests that we're giving. How do we make sure that we get rid of those and ensure every student has access to success? Next priority, again, in the transition is developing and sustaining a connection of peer-to-peer learning. Again, if I go back to professional learning communities and what you'll see in a school where they have quality professional learning communities happening is engaged conversation. So we're looking in this area about time to share curriculum, lesson plans that are working, things that don't work. Sometimes we learn the most from something that wasn't as successful as we wanted it to be, and to be able to share that out, to look at assessments, to look at successful practice, and then also to engage in problem solving when there are practices that are going on that aren't helpful for our students. The next area of focus for us would be to provide educators an opportunity to review the Common Core standards. As we shared earlier, there are some questions about the Common Core standards being developmentally appropriate, so we believe it's prudent for us to take the time to make sure we're really assessing the standards. I believe there's a 15% change in the standards. Each state has the ability to make some adjustments, and we believe that educators in Oregon are ready to really evaluate the standards and make sure that we have them adjusted at each level that need all those adjustments made that need to be made. The additional time to determine the learning on the standards after focused instruction. So really looking at what are we doing as educators as far as guiding the learning of students, what assessments are we using, and making sure that we have in place our classroom, what we sometimes call formative assessments, that are really going to move the dial for our students. The third, or the next is, I'm going to transition into the assessments, and this is where I talked about trying to keep them separate, but here's in our proactive plan, it is about calling for the moratorium, and we're going to ask you to support a moratorium on the Smarter Balance assessment, and there are people who are going to tell you that you're going to lose a lot of money if you do this, and how can you pass up all of that money? I believe that as adults, if we have the conversation with Secretary Duncan about what we plan to do and how we are going to be proactive in looking at how the use of assessments, we're going to be reaching out to ensure that every student has access to quality instruction. But again, do we have the ability as a state to come together and present a plan that is more productive than spending millions of dollars on a test that 65% of our students will fail? I believe we do have that opportunity to do that. We have students who are going to be juniors that are going to be asked to take the Smarter Balance assessment that haven't been taught these standards. When I talked with one elected official about, you know, we're going to ask them to take the assessment, she said, well, you know, but I haven't been in school and I haven't been taught those standards. And I thought, well, that's odd because neither of the students have all been taught to these standards. And we need to scaffold the learning. We need to create a path to having students be prepared to take the Smarter Balance assessment. So if Kentucky is taking it for the first time and they're just beginning to implement the standards, and they have a certain percentage of students that are passing. If we're implementing the standards with fidelity and we're working on those standards, then we shouldn't have 65% of our students fail the first year we give the assessment if we've been scaffolding the learning. That's the plan that we want to look at for our students here in Oregon. So I hope that you will support us in looking for the moratorium. We also want to put together, to help with the moratorium, to help with the conversation, is a panel of educators to review the results of the field testing. We're not asking that we not be able to have the tests go be out in the field and field testing. We're promoting that we should be field testing and then creating the panel that will be able to give us feedback on how things are going. At this moment in time, we have some of our students here in Oregon who have piloted the Smarter Balanced Assessment. Let's learn from that. Let's learn from piloting going forward and then make our decisions on what we should be doing in Oregon based on that information. Next. This is, again, I mentioned the work group that we have, and I couldn't be prouder of the group of educators that have come together to work on this assessment system. But it is our utmost goal to use assessments appropriately with our students so that they have access to quality learning environment in every school across the state and that they're not afraid of assessments. They should want to assess where they're at, and they should learn from that. So this would be our plan in putting in place the assessment protocols that really work for students. And lastly, we would support a waiver for districts who want to pilot alternate educator-designed assessments. Right now, we have districts that are working on creating formative assessments aligned with the Common Core curriculum. And Pendleton, a group from Pendleton came to the OEIB meeting, or the last OEIB meeting, and shared the work that they're doing. And it's amazing the passion that you heard from the educators about what they're doing and how those assessments are really guiding their instruction and how that in itself is what's going to help our students be college and career ready. It's not about giving them an assessment that they're not prepared for. It's about creating an assessment system that really helps them. So with that, I appreciate the time and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you so much, Hannah. What questions do we have for Hannah? You guys all feeling okay? Representative Reardon.
First one, I probably have several, but we should just be sitting down chatting somewhere else. But on the, you talk about PLTs, or project learning teams. At the school that I used to work at, we had PLTs, and we worked on curriculum and stuff for the last at least 5 years, maybe six. Is that universal across the state or not? And it seems like I'm questioning the lack of input that you mentioned in your slides.
Mm-hmm. Chair Gelser, Representative Reardon, I reference PLCs, professional learning communities, mm-hmm. and there are different terms that we use.
Yeah.
And it is district by district what's happening and how they've been implemented. Some are really educator-driven learning communities mm-hmm. where the educators look at the student data that they have in ways that are meaningful for them. Some districts have a form that you fill out and here's what you're going to discuss. So it is dependent on district, and I think if we can talk about some practice, some best practice around how to create that collaborative environment within the educators community, that would be really an effective tool for us.
Okay. Am I the only one with questions, or
yes,
you're
watching
okay. the clock?
But that's okay. Are there other questions for Representative?
I just have a quick kind of pragmatic question, and I think it might sound odd. I wasn't here. I mean, it sounds like there was an actual legislative action to enact these standards. That's what I heard. That was kind of a broad direction to the board to adopt standards, and there was Senate Bill 290, I think, was mentioned. I wasn't here for any of that. So my question is kind of a pragmatic one. When you say you're asking us to support your efforts, what are you asking of legislators? Sign a letter, or is there actual, I'm assuming that there's not legislation that can take place because we won't be meeting again until January of 15 in a way that we can actually vote on things. So what's your ask of legislators if we found your presentation persuasive? What can we actually pragmatically do to help?
Right. Chair Gelser, Representative Fagan, thank you for the question. You can support us by our congressional district has signed on to a letter earlier on about using assessments appropriately to Secretary Duncan. And I think Secretary Duncan has the ability through the waiver process. One of the reasons why we're mandated is because of the waiver. And there are better ways. There's absolutely no research base for some of the things that we're doing because of the waiver. And I think at some point, as adults who care about public education and believe that Oregon can lead the way, if we come together and you're willing to sign on and let the secretary know that we do have a plan, that we're prepared to do things right for our students, we're not trying to shirk any accountability, we are going to look at equity across the state, that we can do this. California doesn't have a waiver, but they're not implementing this the Smarter Balance assessment across the state. They're doing the testing, but they're not using it. And they were threatened with the money, but they're getting their money. So it is our opportunity, I think, to come together and say, we have a better plan, Secretary Duncan, and we would like you to sign on to our waiver, and I believe our congressional delegation can help us as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. It was a very clear presentation, and thank you, committee, for good questions and good conversation. So with that, and I'm sure this is not the last conversation we will have either about the standards or the assessments. So that, I'm going to close the information hearing on the Common Core and Smarter Balanced. We are significantly behind schedule, and Sherry Levery is not always in the building, so we're going to call her up next, and I understand that the CTE presentation was on the record at the Higher Ed Committee, so we may run out of time and members before that happens. So I'd like to invite up Sherry Levery to talk to us about school safety and emergency preparedness. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I don't have this opportunity very often, so I appreciate it very much.
Say that again.
For the record, my name is Sherry Levery. I live in Salem, Oregon. I am a special ed teacher once upon a time who's evolved to a new place in the world. So I want to start just by thanking you all for taking this time.
And as people are leaving the room, could you do so quietly? Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. In order for you to look at what you look at with schools, you have to be experts on a whole lot of things, and I know I couldn't do what you do. I couldn't be, you know, well enough informed in so many different areas, but I have an incredible investment in doing what I do really well, and I thought I was going to be last, and I was thinking they were saving the worst for last because mine is about school crisis, and I know it's something we all wish we didn't have to address, but I really want to look at how decisions are made and kind of where this pendulum is swinging with school safety this time. You know, we had a conversation, Representative Huffman and I had a brief conversation about how many bills can come into play and how many of them can be at odds with one another unless what we have is one unified plan. So for me, this is my field. I started in the 70s doing art and play therapy with kids who were grieving, and in the 80s I went to work for an ESD and created something we called the Flight Team, which was the crisis response teams that were countywide teams of school staff that responded to school crises. So in the 80s I was writing about how to respond after a death of a student. And in the 90s we started having all the school shootings, and so I began looking at what do we need to know about how to survive a school shooting as school people. And I had finished the book and had never printed it all out when I was called to respond to Thurston High School. So I went down knowing that even though I know the people there, because we had been training together for 13 years, that we would all be overwhelmed and that what we would do is put together a plan for meeting the needs of the entire community, the students, the teachers. We had to look at how to coordinate 30 agencies that were all responding and how not to have press releases go out from one agency that either contradicted or made it difficult for another agency. We were coordinating a tremendous number of elements in order to do that, and probably the most incredible was working with the families of the children who had died and their peers. So in order to do that, I really felt like what I needed to do was walk the cafeteria before I met those people. So I feel like what's happened for me as a result of working the Thurston shooting is that I've seen it from another side, and now I've watched what's happened with the pendulum over these years. So after Thurston, I responded to Columbine and spent 10 days there. I spent 2 weeks in New York City after 9/11 with the schools that were 29 schools that were in or around Ground Zero who had to flee and never could return to their schools. So what I've watched over all of these years is that we've had this pendulum swing. Back in the 80s, we really focused on prevention. We did a lot to make a difference in terms of what schools did ahead of time in order to prevent these kinds of events. But what's happening now is that schools, I think because of what's happening at board meetings among and in our culture as a whole, we're spending a whole lot more now on safe entries and how are we going to keep kids from getting into a school rather than preventing what's going on. So there are a few pieces that I just want us to look at. I just want to look at some statistics. And it was pretty interesting. I think that you would be busy on the day of the standardized testing, so I'll just bring the test right now here and ask a few of you the questions in terms of what do we really know about school shootings. So I would not expect anybody as a guess, but does anybody have a guess about how many kids we lose to school violence in a year in America? So we lose 11 kids. If you count the big ones, if you count Sandy Hook and if you count Columbine, we in America lose 11 kids a year to school violence. We lose 11 kids every day to gun violence outside of school. So if you're going to look at where kids are safest, they're still safest in school. The percentage of school shootings that have been stopped by an armed person are 10% or less, and most of the time they didn't have to use force. Most of the school shootings have been stopped or stopped because peers told what they knew. If we look at how many school shooters are homicidal, only 10%. 90% of them are suicidal, and they've got nothing to lose to take these other kids out with them. We cannot profile a school shooter. We know zero tolerance doesn't work. We know threat assessment has a tremendous potential for helping us identify those kids that are at risk. One of the things we need our schools to understand is how to tell the difference about whether or not a student is making a threat or actually posing a threat. These are things that we could have schools learning at this point. These are the things we need to be doing for prevention. If you took any single school building, Bush School might be the closest school to us, that building will have a shooting in it once every 1,286 years. Not that often. We're doing a lot of lockdown drills for something that isn't happening often. If you want to think about your own children, how many of you have children or grandchildren? Yeah? So the odds that your child or grandchild will be shot in a school shooting is less than 1 out of 2.5 million. But the odds that your child will be shot outside of school or die of a gunshot wound outside of school is 1 out of every 1,600. When we have a suicide, it costs our community over $1 million per suicide. It costs $1,600 to provide mental health for that student, so they won't die by suicide. And the other thing, the other statistic, and I'll leave a handout with these statistics on them, but the three most common illnesses, mental illnesses, to happen for kids in adolescence are depression, bipolar, and paranoid schizophrenia. All three of those have a correlation to suicide and a correlation to school shootings. So what I'm hoping, and I love that we had the conversation that we did, and that's to look at how is it that Oregon can begin to have a full plan about prevention. How can we be fiscally responsible? So we can look at what are six things that would make a huge difference in terms of what we're spending, what it's costing us, because we're not preventing some of these things. You know, we had lots more money for prevention in the 80s and some in the 90s, and now almost none. I was talking to Central Oregon. They just had a horrendous event. How many of you know about the suicide that happened inside the school? So we had a kid who walked into a school and died by suicide with 15 or so other students in that classroom. The costs are incredibly high still to what's happening for that school. So what I'm hoping is that Oregon can get to the place of really having a very unified approach that's towards prevention. So the first piece we need to do is put a counselor back in every school. We can't afford to have elementary kids, because 25% of our fourth grade students have passing thoughts about suicide. And it's addictive, that thought of, if my teacher does that again, I could just kill myself and she'd feel really bad in fourth grade. Grows so that in sixth grade it's, if my mom does that again, I could kill myself and I'd use my dad's gun. And then by eighth grade, in order to get that same sense of control, the child is now going in to look and make sure they know where that weapon is. I've never been into a school after a spontaneous suicide. Every single time when I get there, most times people say, we didn't see it coming, but every single time before I leave, I've had people walk into the room where I'm working with kids to give us the evidence. So we need counselors in the elementary schools, because that's when kids begin thinking about this. The second piece is that we actually need mental health workers in the schools. Right now, Portland Public Schools does not have any. They used to have mental health workers, separate from counselors, who dealt with actual mental health therapy for those kids that needed it. And because they have no money for prevention, we now pay way more in treatment for the kids. 80% more now are referred to day treatment than were when they had the mental health specialists in schools. So that's another piece of prevention. The third one is funding suicide prevention and making sure we have that in every school. When I walk into a district, my question is, what do you do for suicide prevention at the kindergarten level? It needs to be K-12, because kids begin having those thoughts in kindergarten. And unless we help them find a new way of thinking about how they're going to cope with their problems, the addictive quality of it is, and I'll use my dad's gun, and then it goes from there. When we talk about this process in terms of prevention, the newest one and the most wonderful one, I think, is what's happening with John Bandrill in Salem-Keizer Schools, which is student threat assessment. It's the leader not just in our nation, but in the world. People who are doing research on student threat assessment in Germany are coming to John. You have him right here. I mean, if we wanted to put Oregon on the map in terms of prevention, you've got people here who could do tremendous things for our schools. His program has been given a stamp of approval from the U.S. Department of Justice, the Secret Service, the FBI, Homeland Security, and the Department of Ed. That should just be a no-brainer for all of us. So if you look at these first four things, and we go back to the shooting that happened at Thurston High School, right? We should be intercepting these kids. You know, what we know about the boy who did the shooting at Thurston is that for him, he didn't intend to get out. He was one of the 90% that were suicidal and have nothing to risk taking other kids out with them. So when he walked into that cafeteria, he not only had tons of weaponry, he had taped a bullet to his chest to make sure that if he shot all those bullets off and didn't have any left in the gun, he would have one to take his own life. Now, it was not stopped by an armed person, although there was a policeman that was in the neighborhood and was at the school. It started at 7:56. The policeman was out of his car at 7:58. But it was stopped because two boys who were wrestlers grabbed this kid when he stopped to reload his weapon and wrestled him to the ground. And the first thing he said is, shoot me. Just shoot me now. If our schools in the 90s had good student threat assessment and good suicide prevention and mental health workers in schools, those are three terrific places to intercept these kids before they get to that place. We didn't know this stuff in the 90s. I've only learned it because I've responded so many times and watched what happens over time. So the next piece, in terms of looking what we need to to add in our, and we all know about this, school climate programs and what is it we can be doing about bullying and that sort of thing. And finally, the last one is that we no longer have any funding for school crisis response. So schools no longer can pay to create the teams that will respond after crises. And here's the role of school crisis response. When you have a small crisis, if you respond really well, you prevent a whole lot of the larger ones. It's when we have a student die in a car accident and we have a room where kids can gather and talk about that, but we also have kids come in to say, you know, I've actually thought about suicide for myself, or I'm worried about my friend. So one of the pieces that I see is that by doing crisis response with the smaller crises, we prevent the cascade of larger ones from happening. I can tell you, we're working real hard in Bend to keep what happened there in February from going on, because from creating more. We just sat down to talk in Bend within the last 2 weeks. That suicide happened in February. And I asked, how much time is it taking now? The fire department and the people who are the responders figure that 8,000 people have been impacted by that death, and they are sure that it's costing Bend more than $1 million. And that I asked the people at the school, there were four counselors there working with the students who were in the room who saw this happen. I asked, what amount of your time is that taking now? Four counselors said 50% per day still. This is within the last 2 weeks. And the school psychologist said 80% per day now still. I will tell you that the team that I trained after the death of the athletic director 20 years earlier, they had an athletic director at Bend High School who died by suicide on the school grounds, and that's why they trained. That's why they have this team trained. And I'm incredibly proud of how well they responded. So now, 20 years later, they're responding to a similar kind of incident. And those people who went into the building, and there were many of them, maybe 30, many of them are still seeking treatment for the secondary trauma that they have because of the stories they had to listen to. So if we can just prevent one or two of these a year, it's huge. So those are the pieces that I look at, is that right now what we're doing is we're barricading our schools, and I'm almost reluctant to say it out loud, but kids who have guns who can't get into school, I don't know why we haven't had one walk into a football game or a soccer match. It's like moving it to another venue doesn't help. Preventing it is what helps. So although you would think, after all the times I've been exposed to the things I've looked at in schools when I walk through these scenes before they're cleaned up, that I would be all about more armed guards and bolstering, you know, putting in our hard entries into our schools. But really, I think we're just entirely missing the boat unless we do prevention. So one of my questions is, you know, who do you turn to? To whom do you turn when you want to know what's happening in the trenches and how the bills you're putting together can have the greatest efficacy? I mean, I would love to work with you on that. I'm sure John would love to work with you on that. You had a whole bunch of kids in this room about 3 hours ago, and I thought, here are these kids listening to us, and how often are we listening to them? And they have the answers. When I went into a school after a ninth-grade boy had murdered an eighth-grade girl in Philomath about 15 years ago, the principal said to me, will the kids feel more secure if we have marked cars in the parking lot, and if we have some guards on site for a few days? And I said to him, Nels, loosen your tie. Take off your jacket. Let's go down and talk to the kids. So we went down to the safe room where these kids knew both the boy who had perpetrated it and the girl who had died. And we talked about some other things, and I said, so your principal wants to know, would you feel more comfortable if we had an armed guard at the school, and would you feel more comfortable if they did wanding or if you had to walk through a metal detector? And it was so great. Six girls jumped on it, and they said, no, but we've been talking about how much we want self-defense taught in PE. We all knew him. And I looked at him, and I said, do you know how much money we just saved? Right? You can find someone to teach self-defense in PE for practically nothing compared to what he was considering in terms of all this bolstering. So that's what I want most of all, is for us to look at how Oregon can make a coordinated plan in terms of what we do for prevention. I will tell you that I don't know if I'll be called again. I get called off and on to go respond to these school shootings, and I've been in after several of them. I'm leaving here tonight to go, yet not because of one that happened now, but because of one that happened not long ago. And I'll tell you that every time I walk in, I am facing these people and thinking to myself, you know, when I had these few minutes with my legislators, did I give them the best I could in terms of what will help us do the best that we can? And it's going to weigh heavy on my mind if the next place I walk in is in Oregon. So I just want to close by, you know, thanking you for taking that time. I will tell you that there was a wonderful man who was giving a presentation, and I was there as the moderator was taking information so she could introduce him for his keynote. And it was a man who had become homeless because of the abuse in his childhood and grown through homelessness and addiction to finding a job, to getting his life together, and now had been chosen by a social worker to create a home for people, 5 adults and 7 children, all of whom had been homeless because of child abuse in their lives. So here were these 7 kids who might have 5 parents show up at a parent conference at school. Mm-hmm. So they formed this home together. It's a marvelous project. And so the woman who was introducing the man said, so, and about your life personally, do you have any children? And he said, oh my, yes, I do. And he said, how many? And he said, well, how many are there? And those words have just guided my work. And I so want them to guide yours. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Are there questions? Representative Fagan.
Yeah, first a comment, then a question. Thank you, first of all, for just such heartfelt testimony and just as a testament to the power of the flight groups that you mentioned. In my first month of being a legislator, a little 5-year-old girl was killed in my community just blocks from where I was living, and just by, you know, it was a car, you know, but she was a kindergartner at the local school, and those flight teams responded so that, you know, because all these kids knew her at school. And I remember, you know, just going to the memorial the day after she died. Her family kind of just did a kind of outside bonfire or whatever, and there really is nothing more haunting than the sound of grieving children, like grieving, they just, the wailing, and it was just a very, very haunting experience. But the flight teams were quite remarkable. They were both at the vigil that night, but then they worked with the elementary school, and her, I think they even worked with the middle school, because this girl came from a large family, so she had sisters who were in middle school, and it was just, the flight teams were really remarkable, so just as a testament to them. A question, in the February session, actually, Representative Huffman and Representative Parrish and I are all three on the Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee,
Okay,
and we
yeah.
passed a bill to create a school safety task force that actually was brought to us by the Clackamas County Sheriff, but it was somebody that, you know, basically he'd gone to a presentation about schools having kind of statewide coordinated ways of preventing these, and I'm just curious if you've heard about that, or are you working with them at all, because you certainly would be a valuable, you know, member of that task force.
Well, here's how I've seen the pendulum swing, and that's that in our somewhat reactionary and fearful place of we have to barricade schools and all of that, and we look at what school safety is, we've moved to a place that's more about surveillance cameras and that sort of thing. And so when people come from a law enforcement background, we have to recognize that their job is to come in when something awful has happened. So that is their job, is to wait till it's at the door, right? And so I'm not disputing that they have a value, but not at the expense of prevention. And so, yes, I'm aware of them, and anytime I've been asked to participate, I absolutely am willing to participate. I think it's very important, but that is, you know, we just have much more emphasis now on the bulletproof glass and some of that stuff. And so it depends on who all is on any committee. I mean, the different counties also have their own committees, and so it depends on who's out them, what on them, what their background is.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair. So, and I appreciate those comments. This was actually, I mean, this was something that literally like 5 months ago we passed. So that there isn't kind of a different response for different counties. This is a kind of statewide school safety task force. So are you actually familiar with that particular one? Or are you saying you've been generally familiar? Because that would be one to connect you up with. Because I know that their goals were certainly, because, you know, this was from one of the sheriffs in particular who actually himself responded to the Clackamas Town Center shooting and stuff. So this was something that I mean, I think that they were also talking about ways I didn't remember them hearing things like bulletproof glass and stuff. I think they were kind of wanting to take a comprehensive approach, but it's a task force, so it's something that is supposed to generate ideas. So I would welcome you to, we can probably somehow get you the information of the folks that are on the...
And you might connect with Tricia on the way out. You want to wave your hand, Tricia?
Madam Chair, that's one of the reasons Daryl Fuller's here. We communicated, and I suggested he come and meet Sherry so that we can make that connection.
Daryl, will you wave your hand, too? All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Further questions?
comments? No. Representative Huffman, thank you very much for making the introduction, and thank you for being willing to come.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you all very much for a very lively hearing. Everybody was really engaged.
It's good. Good stuff.
So we'll see you all tomorrow. Representative Parrish.
Just real quick, June 3rd, if anybody would like to attend, let me know. We've got a few slots left. But Women in Government is hosting a focus group luncheon in Portland. So it's like an 11 to 1:30 at the Embassy Suites. I would just need an RSVP if you want to go. But they are coordinating focus group in five different states, specifically on higher ed. Mm-hmm. But if anybody wants to be there, there are a few slots open.
Can men come too?
Well, they want legislators. Yes, men can come too. Yes, male legislators are welcome.
I've been
personally
invited.
Even though it is Women in Government, right. Jackie Winters and I are on that, working on that as part of their state directors for that organization. But it is June 3rd. They're hosting us. They're bringing in some college students as well as part of that focus group to talk about higher ed issues in the state.
Great.
And then they're going to take what they've learned across the nation and pull it up and make suggestions.
So, anything else for the good of the word? Thank you all very much. We're adjourned.